all here. We'll bring the task force to order and start out with the presentation by the Community Corrections Presentation and Supervision with Mr. John Schmilo and Mitch Christensen. Josh, Mr. Milo, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairs and members of the committee. As you said, I'm Josh Milo, Director of Blue Earth County Community Corrections and also President of the Minnesota Association of Community Correction Counties. Mitch Christensen from 6W Community Corrections and our Legislative Chair is also here with me today to be part of the presentation. For our presentation today, some of the things that we'll be talking about is the county role in felony supervision, community supervision overview, what it looks like for someone to be on felony supervision, violations and the revocation process, a little bit on diversion programs, and then a little bit on resource needs as well. So when we look at felony supervision in CCA counties, there are 33 counties that participate in the Community Corrections Act system. Of those, they supervise 75% of felony probationers and supervised release offenders. And for felony and supervised release offenders, the Department of Corrections supervises the remaining 25%. And one of the things we'll look at is that of the number of individuals that are on felony supervision, which is a little over 40,000, approximately 5% of felony probationers will be revoked in any given year. And just a map looking at where the Community Corrections Act counties are within our state, I see a lot of them really concentrated over most of the metropolitan areas within our state and regional centers, and then there are some areas in outstate with our joint powers where they're also joined together to provide Community Corrections Act services as well. So when we look at felony probation supervision, we really look at what is the goal of supervision. And that goal is changing offending behavior in order to protect public safety. With that, one of the first things we're doing initially is we are performing pre-sentence investigations on felony offenders. When doing those pre-sentence investigations is where we're interviewing the offender, we're doing collateral contact, and we are making those recommendations to the court on what the sentence should be for that felony level offense. As we've heard in many of the presentations before, sentencing guidelines is really dictating a lot of what's done on that. Are there times there are departures, but really sentencing guidelines is really going to be controlling a lot of that on felony sentences. And when we look at supervision, really where we're at is looking at then is the evidence-based practices piece of that and how we're providing those services. And the foundation as part of that pre-sentence investigation range is where we look at the risk needs assessment. This is really the foundation of the supervision that we are providing for our offenders in our community. Is we are doing that evaluation on an actuarial risk tool, and we're taking a look at items as such as their education, employment, their family leisure, alcohol, drugs, their attitudes, their beliefs, their mental health. And when we're taking a look at all of those, that's where we really are making our recommendations on what the condition should be that we are supervising, but then the case management and the case planning that we are doing within the community. So once we have that foundation of that risk needs assessment, that's really where we can work as probation officers to really apply those interventions. Years ago when we looked at felony supervision, really looked at it as more of a brokerage of services. If you look back 20, 25 years ago, there was a condition, there was a probation officer, everything was really just referred out to a community-based process, whether it was chemical dependency, whether it was mental health, and that is something that we really have seen change over the time with the implementation of evidence-based practices. Now, the probation officer has that training in motivational interviewing. They have that cognitive skills training where it's really about that individual intervention within that office. They're spending that time trying to get to that individual that comes in to the point where we would call like the pre-contemplation stage of change, getting them to want to make those changes. So it's really applying those interventions directly in that office. And then part of that with the supervision is we have those direct interventions there within that office setting or in the community base where we're out in their homes or seeing them in the community, but also is connecting them to services. We are connecting them to chemical dependency treatment providers, mental health services, whether that be therapy or psychiatric care, med management. and we're trying to find those within the community. If they're one of their high-risk areas is education, employment, we'll really be looking at how do we enhance their education. That could be through continuing their secondary education. It could be GED services. We'll also be looking at working with workforce centers and trying to find getting them the skills to be employable within the community. But with that, it's not just looking at all of that in a silo. If we say if somebody needs to have work or better education, we look at it, they also have to look at some of their underlying issues. What are their antisocial tendencies? What are their thought process? Because if we just take an individual that has all these other, what we call criminogenic needs, and we have them work, it's really not going to change a lot of their behavior. Now we're going to probably have more of a criminal that has money in their pocket, that has a job, whereas we need to look at the whole system of the individual that we're supervising within the community. And with that, with the evidence-based practices, there also are the conditions that are put on by the court. That might be abstain from chemicals, whether it's alcohol and drugs. That'd be submit to testing. There might be electronic home monitoring. There is that piece of it is the enforcement piece. Because at the bottom line, it is about public safety. And if individuals are doing things in the community that are causing harm, potential harm or harm to others, that's where that enforcement comes in, and they need to also be held accountable. But it's really looking at what are those criminogenic needs, what are those risk factors based on those risk needs assessment. That's how we're looking at trying to enforce them. And really, when we're looking at enforcing and those applying evidence-based practices, it is on the level of risk. So when we look at individuals, the higher risk somebody is assessed at, is that's where we're looking at giving them the most supervision. If somebody is at lower risk with lesser needs, they are getting much less supervision. Something referred to the risk principles, where the research tells us if we give too much time, too much attention to low-risk offenders, we can actually harm them, where we have to give that attention and those services to our highest-risk offenders within our community. And the bottom line when we're looking at how do we protect public safety is how do we impact recidivism? That's really at the end of the day is the goal. We want less people committing crimes again in our community, because every time somebody commits a crime, there's typically a victim. And even when we talk about offenses, when we say possibly victimless crimes, every crime out there really is affecting somebody within the community, whether it's themselves, it's their family, community, if it's property crime. So we're looking how do we make that impact on recidivism. And we really feel that looking at evidence-based practice, and we're looking at probably over about 15 years, it's really been driven hard into Minnesota, into corrections, is that's where we've really been using evidence-based practices. And what we're seeing is we feel the data is also supporting and it's being effective. According to our data definition team that works between the Department of Corrections and Community Corrections Act counties, we've really seen around a 4% recidivism reduction over the last 15 years. And that's for probation and supervised release offenders. So we really feel that the services that we're providing and really focusing on evidence-based practices and not being just a broker of services, but actually doing those intense interventions and applying those interventions in the community with evidence-based practices, is definitely affecting those offenders on supervision. Next part is on supervised release supervision. We'll touch on this, but more of this, the Department of Corrections will be talking a little bit more on supervised release in their presentation as well. The key difference between supervised release and probation is, in probation, it's the governing authority is the judge. The judge is making decisions on issues of revocation. They're making issues on if there's violations. When it's supervised release supervision, it is the Commissioner of Corrections and the Department of Corrections that has authority over that case. They're the ones that are making decisions on revocation or return to an institution. But really, when we're looking at the practices of supervision on supervised release over probation, it is essentially the same type of practices that we are doing within the community. It's that those interventions, focusing on evidence-based practices, seeing what the risk and needs levels are.
Well, Mr. Meinl?
Yes.
Senator Latz has a question. Yeah.
Thank you. Just so I can understand this clearly, the difference in the authorities. So for the felony probation, are those cases where the judge has not sent the person to prison? There's been a felony sentence that has not involved an actual commit to state prison that put them under the Department of Corrections authority?
Is once they revoke and commit them, then it would go under the Department of Corrections authority. But before it's actually would be revoked and commit to the commissioner, all that would be with the district court judge on the jurisdiction and handling that case. And one of the things we do see more of a challenge on those cases that are supervised release, meaning they've been removed from the community, they've gone to a state institution and coming out, is really the release planning. Because that's one thing we see is when we take an individual out of the community, they're gone, and whether they're gone, you know, 6 months or for several years, integrating somebody back into the community is definitely a challenge. And that's one of the places we see a difficulty in those resources. It's difficult for we to have landlords oftentimes rent to the individuals or to have family members that are supportive and pro-social. So that is one of the areas that is really a challenge, and that will be talked about a little bit more, and also some promising items that Department of Corrections and some of that release planning will be talking about. But bottom line is risk assessment, determining what their needs are, and then focusing our supervision on them to try to reduce that recidivism. And we talked about that about 4% reduction in probation supervision. That holds true for supervised release as well. It's about 4%. The one thing we've seen, for those that have been discharged from supervision, the recidivism rates are significantly higher for supervised release offenders. You know, on average, we're looking at about 14 to 15% higher recidivism rates for somebody that is going to prison than those that have been closed out on probation supervision. Having said that, it's really hard to control for what the risk levels are of those individuals, and by nature, we could say that oftentimes somebody that's gone to prison would be higher risk. So we're not exactly apples to apples. Even though it's a higher recidivism rate, there oftentimes could be higher risk offenders as well. Next, I'll turn it over to Mitch to talk about the violation revocation procedures.
Good morning, Chairman Latz, Chairman Cornish, and members of the committee. My name is Mitch Christensen. I'm the director for 6 West Community Corrections. My agency provides all the felony supervision for Chippewa, Lacaprale, Swift, and Yellow Medicine counties, way out on the western edge of the state. Our agency is also a member of the MACAC organization, and I'm the legislative chair for the group. I do want to express my appreciation for you taking the time today to drill down a little further into how we do our business. Probation is challenging, and it's complex. It's challenging and complex for our offenders who are trying to change their behavior and make difficult adjustments in their lives. And it's also challenging and complex for the professionals who are trying to deliver the service efficiently and to make a change. I know that the task of this group is to kind of look at prison and probation as a resource and to manage that resource effectively and efficiently. But I think one thing that we need to remember is that at the core, probation is about individuals. And every single situation that we deal with and every single offender is different. They bring different circumstances with them. They bring different challenges. And that's what judges are dealing with when they are addressing violations. And that's what hearings and release is really having to address when they are dealing with violations. No two situations are the same. So when we're contemplating how to respond to a violation, we're always balancing 3 main objectives. First and foremost, as Josh mentioned, is public safety. We're about protecting the victim. We're about protecting the public in general. But second, and sometimes just under public safety, is intervening in a manner that will most effectively address a client's criminogenic needs and change his behavior in a positive manner for the long run. We're not interested in just locking someone up for the short term of their sentence, although sometimes that has to be done. Yes, you can achieve reduction in recidivism for that amount of time that you lock someone up. But as Josh mentioned, that does not get to the long-term core of impacting recidivism. In order to do that, we need to change long-term behavior. And finally, we need to ensure that clients are held accountable to the terms and conditions of that sentence that the court imposed. So in short, if there's a viable option when there's a violation or a sanction available, and sometimes it's a combination of both, it's an intervention and a sanction that will effectively address a violation, that's the preferred response in Minnesota versus execution of that prison sentence. Ultimately, when we're looking at violations, revocation of probation and commitment to prison is the decision of the court. It's based on recommendations from probation, from county attorney, and defense as well. County attorneys have a very, very strong role in what happens as far as recommendations to court. So the court is hearing several different perspectives and needing to make a decision. Executing a prison sentence in Minnesota is not easy. It's not something that's taken lightly or haphazardly. And there's 2 main safeguards in place that act somewhat as a check and balance in our system. The first is called the Austin Factors. And for those of you who work in the business, you're familiar with what Austin Factors are. This is basically a legal case law standard. It's criteria that has to be met before a judge can execute a prison sentence. There is three main pieces of the Austin Factors. First of all, there has to be a specific condition imposed by the court that the defendant has violated. In Minnesota, we are not allowed for the judge to sentence someone to simply follow all conditions of probation or follow all directions of probation. Each condition must be specifically imposed by the court. The violation must be intentional or inexcusable. Yes.
While you're there, what if the probation contains a clause that be of good behavior and obey all Minnesota laws? Doesn't that cover everything? Other than, you said you had to list specific things.
Correct. So obey all laws is a frequent condition, and for felons, we've moved to standard felony conditions across the state. So obey all laws is a condition. There needs to be a conviction for that to be pursued at violation time. So if it's obey all laws and have no further convictions, which is typically the wording, then you have to get to the point that there is actually a conviction for the revocation process to move forward.
Oh, yes.
I want to make it very clear, but if they get a stay of adjudication or they get a continuance for dismissal or they get kind of a diversion, those don't necessarily count as a conviction. Is that correct for probationary purposes?
Correct. Particularly in the case of a stay of adjudication or diversion or that type of response.
Ma'am, I was wondering, backing up a little again, but a conviction is required. What if it's a heinous crime, alleged crime, and the person is put in jail, but there's no conviction? Isn't that automatically bring up a probation officer into it and say, hey, put a hold on this?
I believe what you're asking about is a kind of a pre-conviction response as far as existing probation versus actually getting to the conviction. And so while you could consider release conditions on a probation violation, when you're dealing with a new offense, it is the legal burden has to be met in the course of the system with the new offense before you can actually get to that standard of having a new conviction. So while the court can consider release factors on the probation violation, they can't actually find that person in violation until there's a conviction. Simply being arrested, simply being charged, doesn't meet the standard of being convicted. That case might well be dismissed as it progresses through the system.
And one thing I would add with that is, you know, at times when there's a new arrest, there's other violations that are with that. There might be chemical use. There might be not completing programming. So you may proceed with a violation when there's a new arrest, but you're really proceeding with the violation on those technical conditions of probation. And when you get in there, you're really not dealing with that new offense behavior until you get that conviction. But oftentimes you are having that process started early.
Representative Hillstrom and then Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to explore a little bit more this. You're law-abiding, you're not convicted of a new offense. You can get a stay of adjudication. So if you have someone who is on probation for a felony DWI and they are told to remain law-abiding and have no new convictions, and then they're eligible statutorily for a stay of adjudication under 15218, they pick up a new drug charge, but they are not convicted with a stay of adjudication, does that meet the definition of a new conviction, or do you only then get them on whether or not they told probation that they had law enforcement contact? Or, I mean, because frankly, if someone's got a, you know, felony DWI and they're on probation and then they are statutorily eligible for a stay of adjudication, I'm not sure that we meant that they shouldn't get a consequence for using drugs while they're on felony probation.
Ms. Christensen, or?
In our area, in order to, if they proceeded through the system, even if they received a stay of adjudication, there would be an admission. There would be a finding or an admission by the court, and we would use that as a basis. But the other thing that would be pursued on a violation in that case is that they most likely had a condition on the previous case to abstain from chemical use. If that were in place, then obviously a new conviction, even if or a new charge that was sustained through a plea or a finding, would meet the requirement, and the person would have to say, yes, I was using chemicals, and that would be pursued as well if the person had an initial condition of failure to abstain. But, you know, Josh, in your area, would you pursue that? I believe you likely would.
Yeah, we'd definitely pursue that, and we would look at that as well, as once they're admitting, I mean, because even with that stay of adjudication or a 152, they are admitting to the factors of that offense. And once they're admitting to those factors of the offense, we would use that for a failure to obey all laws, even if they do not have a new conviction, but they have the 152.18 or stay of adjudication. You know, within that process, where it does get complex, is you have a new offense behavior, you have a violation, is what happens with the plea negotiations between prosecution and defense, that oftentimes I think you will see them kind of melded together into one, where maybe the violation will dismiss if we get an admission for the new offense behavior. But that is something with anything in the court of law, it's really so much with that plea negotiation, what they're doing to either get a conviction. I mean,
Mr. Chair.
Last one.
Follow up, and then Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only reason why I bring that up is because a lot of times around here we hear testimony that people get sent to prison on technical violations with no new convictions. And that is just an example of how really there isn't a new conviction under the statute, but that might be something that might ship someone to prison on a felony DWI case. And so I just think that as we, the legislature, are looking at the reasons why people might get shipped to prison, we have to understand that it's a complicated fact pattern sometimes.
And yes. I think that could be very complicated, because we would look at a felony DWI situation where they are, again, consuming alcohol and behind the wheel, that we think that is very much a public safety issue, whether they have a new conviction or not. So why it may look like a technical violation, it's about public safety. And there are times that on a technical violation, that is, I mean, something that we're going to be recommending, because it's all about public safety at that point.
Representative Constantine and then Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the new conviction and the judge establishing release conditions, does the probation, is that bought into that decision?
Are you asking if on the new case, if the judge is considering the existing probation as
correct.
Well as establishing release conditions? For the most part, I would believe yes. There are a significant number of offenses in Minnesota where a pretrial bail evaluation is mandated by statute. And so if a pretrial bail evaluation is done, that is going to include information pertaining to the subject's prior history, as far as in addition to the fact that he is currently under probation supervision, who he's on supervision to, that type of thing. We also include in our pretrial bail evaluations prior warrants history and prior revocation of sentence probation violation history. So the judge has that. Pretrial bail evaluations are not mandatory on all felonies. It's crimes of violence, any 152.18 felony drug charge, any domestic assault offense, whether it is misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor. But even if a pretrial bail evaluation isn't done, sitting on the bench now, the judge does have access through a CSER Mensis report to see, at least in Minnesota, what is this person's history. And so they are able to see that. And I believe, at least in our jurisdiction, the judges are looking at prior history when taking into account what release conditions are adequate and called for on that new offense. The other thing I want to just bring up as far as the violation being tied into a new offense, if on the probation existing case, we choose to either put that person in custody or do a show cause on the existing case, and the only violation is this new offense, if the judge determines that it's not appropriate for that person to be released and he wants them held in custody, statute and court procedure then puts into play a 7-day time period where we have to have that full contested revocation in 7 days while that person is in custody. So you've got a legal problem there, because the only alleged violation is this new offense, and that's still going through the court process. So you can't really pursue a violation when the person is going through the court process in 7 days on the violation. Does that make sense? it's difficult to get to that point and hold someone in custody and wrap up that violation in 7 days when they haven't gone through the process in the new case. There's been no finding of guilt or admission of guilt.
A follow-up?
So somebody's got 15, 20 years hanging over their head. They've gotten a really good deal, and they come in for a gross misdemeanor, which is a violation of law and would be a probation violation. But if they don't do a bail study, is it possible that the judge might not know that this person has motivation to run if they let them out?
On gross misdemeanor cases, I believe the judge would have access to their criminal history, at least. That's going to be provided for them in the charging documents, usually, at least reference to, if it's gross misdemeanor DWI, this is what's got them to the gross misdemeanor point. If it's a domestic assault that's enhanced, this is why it's enhanced. The subject has two or three priors in this year. That's the way I typically see complaints, and I think complaints are usually written around the state. So for the most part, I would have to say judges do have, even in gross misdemeanors and misdemeanors where there aren't pretrial bail evaluations, they do have access to the history of that person. But it's really up to the prosecutor to make a case for factors that would call for that person to be held, whether they be a flight risk, a risk to public safety, et cetera. That's the job of prosecution at the point of a first appearance on that alleged offense.
Thank you.
Senators Goodwin, Lantz, and Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, I want to go back a little bit, because it sounded like what you said a little earlier was that if somebody admits that they used a chemical, they're in more trouble than if they don't admit they used a chemical. Is that what you were saying? If they say, yes, I used it, then they're almost automatically violating their probation, which brings in, I'll let you answer, but I also want to know what that is then. You know, how fair is that to somebody that can't afford an attorney versus that would advise them, you know, not to say anything versus somebody that's just on their own?
Well, Senator Goodwin, I would say that if somebody admits, I mean, that is something you definitely like within the profession if they admit to their behavior. But we look at it, if it's a technical violation and somebody's admitting to chemical use, the standard that we're typically using, and we look at, Midge will be talking a little bit about graduated sanctions, is our response on a chemical use isn't going to a violation or a revocation. With looking in our process, if somebody's being honest about their use and they're admitting, is it something that there'll be accountability? Yes, but it's really, how does that treatment response look like? We might be looking at, we want them to report more often to probation. We might enhance their drug testing. A lot of places around the state will have like a color code system. We'll put them on that. We'll be, if they're not in treatment, we'll be working with maybe an updated chemical health assessment, or maybe they need to be in outpatient or inpatient treatment. But it's really that sanctions that we're looking at, where we are starting low. And this is something that we talked about when Mark Levin from Right on Crime was here, is that graduating sanctions response is that we're not jumping to revocation. Now, if somebody continues to use, and with all of these graduated sanctions, they're not going to stop, will it be a little more punitive for them? It possibly could, but it doesn't even mean that's revocation. That might mean after several times we might be looking at just going back to court for the first time, or there might be a short jail sentence. But it's really about, is how are we responding to that need? And if that use is really about their chemical dependency, it's responding to that need because we know that they need treatment. We need to change that behavior, not just incarcerate on that.
Senator Lantz.
So with regard to this this conviction, it sounds like it's conviction or admission to the conduct that is alleged in the new criminal charge. But when a judge sentences probation, says no arrests supported by probable cause for certain kinds of offenses, is that considered a separate term, more specific than the remain law-abiding, so you're not requiring a conviction for those or an admission for those violations? Because I hear it all the time where the judges say just no arrests supported by probable cause.
I would have to say, and I am not an attorney, and there's certainly attorneys in the room.
I'm sorry.
I am not a judge. But I do believe, and in my own area, what I see is that it would be, I believe, judicially difficult to move forward with a violation based on have no further arrests. You or I could walk out of here today and be arrested. That is not supported necessarily through going through the process of probable cause level or actually proving that behavior rose to the level that supported the violation. And so have no further violations of law, convictions, that type of thing, that's a different standard to me. But we don't typically see, in my area anyway, and we get transfers in from all over the state, we don't typically see have no further arrest. It's usually obey all laws, have no further convictions is what we see.
And clearly in our cases, any such arrest would not have been supported by probable cause, right?
Precisely.
Exactly.
You're escorting me out of here.
But Mr. Church, I think that's where it's important when we look at it, when we look at our court of law and our Constitution, and that notion of innocent until proven guilty, is that somebody could be alleged to have committed a crime, and that's where we're looking at that that evidence and that beyond a reasonable doubt before there's violation.
Senator Newman.
First of all, to either testify or, excuse me, I've got my back turned to you as I ask the question, but if I don't speak into the mic, I'll be scolded. So, on the slide that is up right now, it says many counties use sanctions grids and sanctioned conferences before violations get to court. It talks about graduated sanctions. And then in your next slide, it says that there is a sanctions grid and violations criteria, and an awful lot of the discussion that we've been having right now is, you know, when is a violation going to occur, and so that really, to me, is the violations criteria. My questions are: where's the legal authority for the creation of the sanctions grid and the violation criteria, and are the sanctions grid and violations criteria uniformly enforced throughout the state of Minnesota, or is it done by county by county? And my third question is, can you provide us either with copies of these grids and criteria or tell us where we can find them?
Ms. Christensen.
Yes, Senator Newman, if I could back up, because I think a little bit of additional information about the Austin factors will help to answer your questions. So the Austin factors are kind of over here in the legal system, the case law standard for execution of a sentence. In order to execute someone's prison sentence, as I mentioned earlier, you have to meet the Austin factors. The judge cannot just haphazardly say, you didn't come to one probation appointment, we're executing your prison sentence. It's not allowed under case law in Austin factors. So in addition to the specific condition that was violated, the judge has to make a finding that the violation was intentional and inexcusable. And then the judge needs to find that the need for confinement outweighs the policies favoring probation. There's three ways to get to this. It's necessary to protect public safety to commit someone to prison, or the client needs a correctional treatment service that can better and more effectively be obtained in the prison system. The final one that comes into play frequently is that it would unduly depreciate the seriousness of the violation of the probation if the probation was not revoked. The court has gone on to say that the decision to revoke probation should not be a reflexive reaction to an accumulation of technical violations. It requires a showing that the offender's behavior demonstrates that he or she cannot be counted on to avoid antisocial activity. So the court has actually weighed in with case law and as I said, made it standard practice that you cannot just out of the blue determine you know, I don't like that you missed an appointment. I don't like that you had a dirty UA. You're automatically going to prison now. The court has set a threshold that has to be met. Because of that threshold, many counties have come in and adopted graduated sanctions. That's pretty much the way we operate all across Minnesota. To answer your question about grids, some counties have gone to actual grids and criteria that are more pronounced, particularly the bigger counties where you have a large organization that you're trying to get folks to respond in a uniform manner. Other counties, it is more in policy and practice, and that's the case, for instance, in my area. We have a practice that if it is a lower level violation, there's an appropriate intervention that we can apply, then we're going to start off with a sanctions conference. Sanction conferences in Minnesota are authorized in statute. So statute has come in, the legislature has come in and allowed counties to respond to violations, whether it be Department of Corrections or CCA counties. We can respond to violations through use of a sanctions conference. Sanctions conference is where we call the offender in, we discuss the violation. If he wishes to admit and he says, yep, as Josh mentioned earlier, I'm having trouble using, I need treatment, I need assistance, he's willing to comply with the intervention, and there's an appropriate intervention available based on his risk, then we're going to implement that intervention and he's going to agree to it. That's going to go to the judge to sign off on, but he never makes a court appearance. It's never a formal probation violation that is pursued. And as long as he complies with the intervention, then he's never going to go to court on that violation.
And within the sanctions conference, there would be no executed jail time. That would be more of an intermediate sanction within the community of programming. But if it's a sanctions conference where they're not appearing, they don't have the defense attorney present, no jail time could be executed or prison time for that matter.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the short answer to my question would be that the violations criteria are established at least in part by the Austin factors, which is really case law.
Correct.
And the sanctions grids are not necessarily enforced uniformly throughout the state of Minnesota.
I would have to say that is the case, yes, because in CCA, counties are individually responsible for delivering their service. Yes, there is not, for probationers anyway, a standard uniform grid across the state. There are some standard things, though, that each county takes into consideration. Certainly risk, as Josh talked about. The offender's public safety risk is determined by his risk needs assessment is important. The equally important thing, as I mentioned, is what intervention is available that meets the need of this defendant. If there's an intervention that's appropriate, then we're going to pursue that. But two things have to be in place for that to happen. There has to be an appropriate intervention available resource-wise. The second thing is that the defendant has to be willing to comply with that needed intervention. He has to be interested in, at the point of voicing and participating in that intervention. If those things aren't there, then we're going to have to pursue a violation. And that's usually a step up in the sanctions graduated process.
And just, I think you're also referencing the next slide, which is supervised release and sanctions grid. We'll get to that momentarily, but that's where there is uniformity across the state on those commissioner corrections cases where there is a grid for all supervised release offenders. So we'll get to that momentarily, but that is very uniform across the state.
All right, and don't be afraid to, if somebody asks a question in the future, just to say, instead of answering now, just say it'll be covered in the future in the presentation. Ms. Moses, followed by Director Franklin.
So you've mentioned domestic violence several times in your presentation, and we know that one of the things that empowers domestic violence offenders is their ability to violate conditions, contact victims, and not be held accountable. You've also mentioned the need for appropriate intervention. So I have kind of a two-pronged question. The first of all is, can you talk about access to domestic abuse programming or batter intervention programming? And can you talk about that in the context of violations, kind of what your access is to that, and how that plays into violations? And if you could also answer that in the context of probation as well as the context of supervised release. And you may wait for the second part of that question.
Ms. Christian?
Yes. So I'll try and keep in mind all of your things, and if I don't get all the points, please remind me. So with regard to domestic abuse offenders, there is state statute that does require that offenders who are convicted of 518B mm-hmm. domestic offense violations engage in domestic abuse treatment. Mm-hmm. However, I would say across the state, obviously, that resource is available at a different level. Mm-hmm. It is pretty much available around the state, but in my area, for instance, we have, my jurisdiction covers roughly right around 3,000 square miles. We have two programs. Mm-hmm. One in Marshall, one in Willmar. I have people who live all the way on the South Dakota border. Mm-hmm. So that's a significant travel distance. They meet weekly for 26 weeks. The second issue is funding for that. Mm-hmm. That is not a service that is covered under insurance or anything like that. Our DAP program is $500 out of the offender's pocket, mm-hmm. and you have to pay a good chunk of that up front to even start. So that is a resource issue as well. Travel in our area, a lot of times our offenders don't have driver's license. Mm-hmm. You can't get access if you're under MA or that type of thing for CD treatment. You can get transportation provided as part of the insurance. That's not available for domestic abuse treatment. So that is definitely an issue. We have colleagues here from the metro. I know there's certainly more providers here in the metro area. And you've got public transportation as an option, et cetera. But yes, resources is definitely an issue. The second piece that I would just address, you asked about offenders being able to circumvent violations or avoid violations because of secrecy and that type of thing. That is difficult. Most offenders that have domestic abuse violations have conditions related to have no further assaultive behavior. Mm-hmm. But again, we're constantly going between this interplay of what is the condition that was ordered versus what's the burden of proof needed to pursue a violation. Mm-hmm. So frequently we run into an issue where there is threatening behavior going on. The victim reports it to us, mm-hmm. but when it gets to the point of what is necessary to go through a violation procedure, defendants have the right to ask for a contested revocation hearing and to have the state prove the alleged violation. And if the victim is not willing to go through that process and we have no other corroborating evidence, witnesses, police report, et cetera, we really have nothing to support a violation. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That is very difficult.
Yes.
Have I addressed the two things that you had? Is there something further?
Yes. No, and I'm interested as a follow-up on the supervised release piece of it, and I know you guys aren't there yet, so
right.
When you get there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Christensen.
Other questions?
Well, we got a list here. Oh. Oh, no, that was the last one on this. Go ahead, Senator.
Okay.
Director Franklin, I'm sorry, he was there.
That's well, right, I thought I heard Senator. His name.
I crossed his name off.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Director.
I yield.
The question I have on this issue is very similar to her question, and that is what is your availability for mental health resources when you need them? For example, if you think that a parolee, probationer needs to, probationee, whatever you call them, needs to have a crisis bed or maybe residential treatment or needs even a psychiatrist or whatever, what is the opportunity for you to get the services that you need for that person?
Ms. Christensen or Mr.
Miles? Senator Goodwin, mental health services are extremely difficult in this state right now. Mm-hmm. And I know that this group has touched on that already. I know a number of you are also on health and human services committees, et cetera. So you have some idea of what the need is in the state. It's very difficult. And I would add on top of it for our population, it is made more challenging by their behaviors oftentimes. We don't have cooperative folks. We have combative folks. We have threatening individuals. And so oftentimes the first line of resource in order to protect public safety, although the underlying problem is mental health, is the local jail. That's mm-hmm. where they end up. And local jails are just not equipped. They're not mental health triage centers, but that's the role that they have been placed on. So while we can deal with their immediate behavior, getting access to that secondary ongoing assessment or treatment or intervention is extremely difficult.
And one thing I would add with that is it probably also depends a little bit on where you live within the state and the potential resources. You know, I look in our community in Blue Earth County where we do have a mobile crisis response team. We have a crisis center. We have a little more mental health. But when you get into more sparsely populated areas, it's going to be a lot more difficult to access those resources. And especially, I think, when we're looking at that psychiatric care. I mean, that's where we're seeing, I mean, whether it's for adults we're talking about or you could talk about adolescents. Psychiatric care and med management is really difficult for the population.
Thank you. Follow up. Mr. Chair. Thank you. So I know that it's difficult to get anybody a bed or because we have the lowest number of beds in the state here of any state, but how much more difficult must it be to get somebody that's on probation or has had a conviction in the past or certainly a felony conviction to get... If you do have places available, is it difficult to get them into those places because of their past records? And does that, because to me it seems, I just have to say that, it seems like it's kind of a very difficult situation to put probation officer, parole officer in when they know this person needs treatment, they can't get it for them, so they continue to either use chemicals because they're not on medication or they continue to get into trouble, and yet it's all symptoms of their disease, not necessarily bad behavior. But I also know that when somebody doesn't have a record, it's very difficult to get them a residential treatment bed or whatever, and if they do get in, if they spit or if they show any aggression at all, then the police are called and they're removed and put into jail anyway. And that's the situation we have here in Minnesota now, is that the places that are residential treatment aren't going to take care of those. So I imagine it's compounded, hugely compounded by the fact that a person has a record or may have had some aggression in the past. Is that, I mean, so how do you get them into anywhere if they need to?
I think, Senator Goodwin, you've pretty much hit the nail on the head. I don't know that there's much that I can add to that other than that is the crux of the problem that the court has to consider. As I mentioned earlier, how we respond to violations is in large part based on, is there an acceptable intervention available? And increasingly for our high-risk population, who are assaultive, not only in mental health treatment, but in chemical dependency treatment, it's difficult to find a facility, particularly if they have been discharged from previous facilities due to aggressive behavior, and they have mental illness going on as well, to find a dual diagnosis facility in the community that will treat them. I think the other thing we need to keep in mind is it is not just about treatment, it's about appropriate treatment. Mm-hmm. So when Josh was talking about those criminogenic needs, when we deal with offenders, they have underlying cognitive thinking distortions, they have underlying behaviors. It's not enough to just treat their chemical dependency. There's this other wealth of things that is driving their behavior. And so trying to find a treatment program that also will address the underlying issues that offenders bring to the table is part of the responsivity piece. And I think Minnesota struggles to find adequate beds to treat the general population as far as chemical dependency and mental illness, not to mention the extra issues that offenders bring to the table.
Thank you.
Director Franklin.
In your opening comment, you specifically said in Minnesota a conviction, and then you went on, like, kind of deduced from that perhaps other states are different. And I guess my question is kind of about threefold. One, the Austin decision that you referenced, is that state or is that federal? Second, how do we compare to our Midwest states, the Dakotas, Iowa, Wisconsin, and or different from the national or the other population? And I'm speculating that the general public has no clue. I have 10,000 colleagues in the state, and I've learned something here today that I was not aware of. Representative Schoen obviously would be, because he's way ahead of me on the law enforcement. But I think the majority of us don't understand some of the technicalities of your work. And I'm just kind of wondering how we compare to our neighboring, because we compare each other from time to time and criticize, and maybe unjustly sometimes, with that criticism.
Mr. Meinl or Ms. Christensen?
Mr. Franklin, the Austin factors are Minnesota-specific. It is case law in Minnesota. It's not federal law. As far as how Minnesota compares to other areas of the state, the reason I preface my comments with Minnesota is because of that. Each state is in charge of setting their factors related to how probation violations are handled, burden of proof, et cetera, and case law in other states. Minnesota has developed specific statutes that impact how we do our work, and also then case law out of that. And we do have to operate within that, within the confines of that system. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Josh. I'm not aware on a national level of how other states, you know, some of those thresholds, et cetera. I'm afraid I don't have information on that.
Mr. Meinl?
I have nothing further to add on that.
I don't know if this is the right time to bring it up now, or if when somebody else comes up to the table, then you'll be gone. But I wanted to pose a question: is are we failing the system or not? And I don't mean just probation, but recently we had a high-profile death, and the news examined it and said that this person never would have died if he would have been in jail. And we're thinking about we're having a problem with too many revocations and sending people to prison on supposedly minor violations. But the public, if you look at the social media and how they respond in the street, they said, what do you mean? He commits a felony, he goes to prison, he gets out on probation, one strike, and he should go or she should go back to the clinker. So we're trying to weigh the two. And they say recidivism is low, but almost every single case you see in the media, they have a long criminal record, and people are getting so tired of seeing arrested in 2006, released in 2008, arrested in 2010, released in 2012, and then commits a murder or rape. So how are we going to fix this system to balance the public need for protection against, naturally, if we revoke everybody, we're going to have to build three more prisons. So that's not the answer, and we all know that. But how do you folks, because the blame game goes on the prosecutor for making too good a deal with the defense, then the blame game goes on the judge because he didn't sentence them long enough, and the blame game goes in probation because they should have revoked the probation. So everybody's playing the blame game, but how do we fix it? And the reason I'm asking you folks is after you leave, I won't be able to ask you, but we've got Mr. Solhide, Department of Corrections, on revocation with some valuable information too. But what's your input to that problem that we face?
Well, I'd like to say Deputy Commissioner Solhide would have all the answers to that, but I won't put him on the spot like that. You know, I think those are very difficult questions because we're talking about human behavior, and we know human behavior cannot always be predictable. But when we look at, you know, and that's really where you're trying to look at that triage, that you do act differently on higher risk offenders. Higher risk offenders that are especially violent offenders, there is definitely more of a zero tolerance. And as somebody is a lower risk, or which you'd maybe even, you know, not necessarily a lower level crime, but lower risk, there will be a different response. You know, and this is one that I'm going to throw this out there, that we say, well, are we revoking too many people? You know, we look at what we have of over 40,000 felonies on supervision in our state, and in any given year, around 5% of those are revoked and returned to prison. Over the course of somebody's time in probation, it'll be a little bit more than 5%, but the way we're also set up in the state of Minnesota to do supervision is we give many more people chances at supervision on the front end. So, I mean, we look at, yeah, our prison population has been rising. You know, we're still around 10,000, where our neighbor to the east is over 20,000. We give so many more opportunities on the front end that I think it's really indicative of how our system works. We're going to have more revocations, and we're going to have more violations because we have more individuals that are higher risk on the front end on supervision. You know, we could take that and say we're going to put more people in prison on the front end, but we've also seen and we've heard from some of our prior testimony that prison in and of itself is criminogenic. And so if we have somebody that's lower risk or moderate risk, can we keep them in the community? Having said that, when you made the reference to, you know, the prior arrests and prior behavior, there's no question that those repeat offenders get a lot of attention, and the repeat offenders are the ones that are in the news. But those repeat offenders, and especially those violent offenders, those are the ones that we are trying to target, and those are the ones within our system, I think, We feel good at times that they do need to be incarcerated because they are representing a threat to our public. So it's really trying to, again, that old triage of getting those higher risk offenders there versus the low risk.
You know, the problem we always face is it's easier for me in a more conservative stance to say, well, they don't recidivize or they don't recommit if they're in prison, and that's naturally the two easy way out. And so we've got to balance what we hear from our constituents and their need for public safety. Like the governor made a very good statement a few months back when he said he had to worry about, I can't remember how many million people in the state, the population of Minnesota, versus against so many people that screwed up. And so I kind of agree with that thinking. We've got to not only think about these people in jail, but when we release them. So it's a struggle. Senator Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to be clear that right now what you all have been talking about is probation and not supervised release and revocation after someone's been incarcerated. So there's really two different populations that I think we're talking about. And relative to, you know, your comment, Mr. Chair, about the individual who had a criminal record, the media never reports on those individuals that have had criminal records that have had no offenses and that have reintegrated into society successfully and all of that. So I think we need to be, you know, cognizant that what the media reports is not necessarily the reality of what's happening out there. And if only 5% of people that are given probation are having revocations, that probably means that we're probably at a success rate with probation of, you know, in the 80 to 90% range of individuals that successfully go through their process and complete their probation. So I think we need to look at it in the context of there are a few individuals, and my guess is there'll always be a few individuals, and that I'm not so sure that we can create a system that's perfect, because if we did have a system that was perfect, then we wouldn't have individuals that are doing their time when they're incarcerated and not reoffending when they come out. And, you know, the question is our system that locks people up and then has them reoffending when they get out, have we done our job when they've been locked up as well?
Well, and just to add to what Mr. Chair, what you were saying is, I mean, there are times in this profession, there's no question. You when you said if they're incarcerated, we know they're not going to recidivate. And I think there's a lot of us that, yeah, I mean, that's what we want. But we also look at a system where we know that about 95% of individuals that go into prison are going to come back out on the streets. So I completely understand is how do we target those right ones, but if we know they're coming back out, is how do you give those resources so that they're not going to commit new offenses? Having said that, we know with human behavior, it is not, you're not going to always target everyone. There are going to be mistakes. People are going to commit offenses, but how do you, with the resources and with the expertise you have to try to prevent those possibly that are the highest risk to commit new offenses? And it's possible there'll be individuals that we consider low-risk offenders could go out and commit a heinous crime or have no criminal history and commit a heinous crime. It's really hard to predict.
And Representative Dean, I agree with you. That's why I phrased my comments in public perception, not fact. So Representative Hilsberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually going to ask Mr. Ward this question, but he's not in the room at the moment. So I guess I'll make it as a statement rather than as a question. Do you find statewide, and maybe you can answer the question, do you find statewide that the majority of the probation revocation hearings are not contested, that they don't go to contested hearings, and that mostly there is an admission that probation was violated at some point, and then the judge ultimately decides the consequence?
Mr. Meinl.
You know, I would say that the vast majority are not contested. I think I see it's pretty rare that we see contested violation hearings. I think oftentimes we see it as scheduled and set for a contested violation hearing. By the time that hearing is scheduled, there's an agreement in place. And that might be an agreement between the defense and prosecutor and probation that this will be, and then the judge will follow that, but the judge is making that decision without a contested hearing.
And I would add, I think typically when matters are set for contested revocations, it is not the nature of the violation that is being contested. They call them contested revocations, but what the defendant really wants to do is be able to argue what the disposition should be. it's not so much about, yes, I did or didn't do that violation. It's more about what's going to happen.
Thank you.
Mr. Myler, Mr. Christensen, do you think that you would not like more direction from the legislature more or less? One of the hints in the paper was that there needed to be more standard set of circumstances or criteria on these violations where they were either sent up or sent out. Do you like the autonomy, or, I mean, do you like the freedom of action? Or because I'm not saying it's out of control, but there's such a vast differences, I think, that Mr. Solheid will probably convey when he comes up here, of why a person is revoked in one county and why they're not in another. And I suppose you could go same with sentencing, but is there a way to put a standard set of guidelines, or are we going to get containing you too much and not give you enough options?
I think, Mr. Corners, the issue, as I mentioned when I started my presentation, is that we're dealing with human beings, and we're dealing with, I've been doing this for close to 25 years. I've dealt with countless individuals. Every single circumstance is different. Their risk level is different. What they bring to the table is different. What the resources are available at that time is different. Where they are at as far as seeking help and being cooperative with an intervention that will be successful potentially, or not being willing to gauge, that is something that in every single case you're trying to make that determination. And so, in my opinion, it is hard to come in and set mandatory minimum, so to speak, or a hard and fast grid that if you have this, then this happens. I know we do it in sentencing to some degree through sentencing guidelines, but once you get into violation type issues, there are so many factors that go into consideration as far as what is the appropriate response at this given time that will both protect public safety but impact the offender's change in behavior, that I think that's very hand-tying to do that. I'm more interested in the issue of how do we have adequate resources and responses to deal with violations and keep folks in the community safely versus committing them to prison because we have no option, which is a much more costly proposition for the state.
Do you feel you have enough authority right now? Do you need more authority, in other words, on the ability to bring people in for certain violations, or if we restrict it too much to set the bar too high before you can reach out and pull somebody back and talk? Or you have adequate enough power or authority right now?
My comment to that would be I think we have adequate authority and power. Certainly there's a good check and balance between judge, prosecution, defense, probation. It's not like we are making these determinations singly in a silo. But the system has limitations as far as its capacity, and there is definitely issues with the speed at which we can deal with violations, especially once they hit the court system. When the Right on Crime individual is here, he did talk about the swift and certain aspect of it. Swift and certain is hard to achieve in the system right now, especially if it is at the point sanctions conference. We can do that, and that's part of the reason we do sanctions conference, because we can more quickly get in and address behavior. But we can't apply a jail sanction or that type of thing out of a restructure conference. So if you're talking about actually filing a violation and going through the court process, court is pretty backed up for a lot of things right now. So it is more difficult to get the swift and certain aspect when you're going through the court process.
Mr. Meidel?
I would just add is definitely we like autonomy, no question about that. But having said that, I think we also have to get it right. And, you know, one of the things, this isn't just done in a bubble, is we work on how we do sanctions and sanctions grids. We also submit a plan to the Department of Corrections, a comprehensive plan that is established per statute. In a couple of weeks for that every two-year plan, Deputy Commissioner Solheid will be down. One of the things we'll be talking about is violations and community resources and how do we do that. So there's also that accountability within the state where we're having those conversations. So we're making sure that If there's something we're not doing right within our comprehensive plan, that we are looking at that as a statewide process right now. So although there is a significant amount of autonomy from county to county based on what the needs are of that county, there is also a system in place already where we can review and look at those processes.
Before we take any more questions, how much of your presentation do you have left? Any more slides?
Just a couple.
Okay. Representative Hilsman, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a couple of clarifications. So in the event that this legislature decided to do a grid or say this is the sanction that should be for this kind of behavior, why would this be any different than the departures that you currently see in sentencing, right? A judge can always decide that that grid doesn't meet the proper sanction for this defendant and not follow the grid. So would we then have to keep track of departures in probation sanctions in the same fashion that we keep track of departures in sentencing guideline sanctions?
Either one.
Anyone? You may be sentencing guidelines is the more proper place to answer that question or corrections?
Mr. Roy, or Commissioner Roy.
I think this notion of that's come up around this table this morning is local control versus state mandate. And one of the foundational considerations for the Community Corrections Act 35 years ago or so was that individual communities and counties can establish community correctional standards rather than the state dictating those. And here in Minnesota, we have a very strong county system, and we have testified in the past that we believe this Community Corrections Act has really done good for the state of Minnesota and given those counties and communities the ability to set to a degree their own standards and reflect their community goals with community advisory boards, with local judges having pretty strong say in some cases about what happens to their local offenders. So to go to a strong state mandated system for lower level offenders who are ending up on probation, I think would be very difficult and contrary to the Community Corrections Act.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the reason why I asked that question is because, so as a prosecutor, I've seen cases where ultimately you think the defendant should go to prison because they've committed a new offense. However, under Minnesota law, in order to have a no-contact order, you actually have to have someone on supervision. That no-contact order goes away when you ship someone to prison. So I actually had a case where the defendant was convicted of a new crime, but the victim in the original crime is begging, please don't send that person to prison because a no-contact order for 20 years is more important to us than a 8-month prison sentence. And so when you put a grid or a chart into place, you don't take into account some of those other factors that you might see in why you may or may not send someone to prison. So I would just caution us to think about those standards if we're thinking about doing those graduated or mandatory sanctions, that sometimes you have situations like in the domestic violence or in cases where there are no contact orders that maybe there's a reason, even though everyone thinks this person probably should go to prison, there are reasons not to send that person to prison, and those no contact orders might just be that one reason. So unless we're going to change the no contact order law so that you can still have those no contact orders enforced while somebody's in prison, there's a whole other set of factors that so far we haven't even talked about.
I think that's a very good point, Representative Hillstrom, and also the issue of resources. It just keeps coming back to resources. So if you have a grid and the same intervention resources are available across the state at the same level and ability to access those, that's one thing. But as we've talked about, the disparity in what is available in different regions, transportation, funding, etc., it's very difficult under the auspices of autonomy in the Community Corrections Act to say that, you know, someone who, if the going rate is we're not going to revoke the person in this situation because there's an assumption that you can treat them in the community or there's resources and that's just not available in that area, that's difficult to deal with. That's a very difficult situation to be in. as the local community.
Ms. Mitchell, and then there was somebody over here, about three here. And then we've got two more presentations after this, so after these hands are up, let's try to move on here.
I just wanted to also follow up on the sanctions grid concept and just Representative Hillstrom's question. California actually attempted to enact a statewide grid when they went into the realignment process where they had to move people from prison down to the local level. And it failed there because of exactly what Ms. Christensen just said. They didn't have the same services available everywhere. So a grid is more effective when it's local and it's reflective of the interventions that are available within that locality. So unless we get to a statewide level of service, then the local approach is the better approach. I think that the one thing that might be missing in Minnesota is the ability to allow the probation departments to order a quick dip in jail. Other states allow 1 to 2 day jail sanctions or a couple of day jail sanctions for certain more serious violations, and they found that to be quite effective, but we have a bar to that in Minnesota. So that might be one thing that we could add to their authority that might strengthen their sanctions grids and give them more tools to work with.
And I think, let's see, Mr. Wright from the Senate, did you have your hand?
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chair. Just, I was wondering if you could address, when we're talking about standards, the duration of probation, because there's really no limit other than the statutory maximum on how long the judge can put an offender on probation. And is that something that it would be helpful to have? I know some states have their sentencing guidelines include the duration of probation if somebody is not committed to prison, if you have a comment on that or not.
My comment to that, Mr. Reitz, would be that we do see probation sentences as far as length vary widely around the state. It does impact overall numbers on probation and resources. I guess I don't know if I'm prepared to respond to that as far as the appropriateness of that.
Mr. Hazy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is actually related to that and sort of the flip side of mostly what we've been talking about, but it falls under your general subject. We know that some individuals get very long terms of probation in Minnesota. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they're, you know, 10, 20, 30 years even. And I have a couple of questions on that topic. One is, can someone get discharged from probation early? Could you give a quick summary of what the process is? Is that process uniform by county? Assuming that people, their risk level goes down as they're successful on probation over time, if they could be released, would that help on your workload? And on this topic of if there's some sort of legislative intervention that could help, is there anything there that could help make that more uniform and allow more people to be released early when it's appropriate, when they no longer pose a risk? Sorry for so many questions in there, but.
Well, I could, first off, starting out is the decision to discharge early would definitely be, that's a judicial decision. Once they're sentenced, the judge can make that decision, but the recommendation would often come from probation. And that is something that you look at that would be different for each county where they would be with that their early discharge policy. From what I know and discussed within our colleagues is that each county has that early discharge policy. And that's where we look at with a policy within ours is we really look at trying to take that risk level into effect. Is when they've completed all their conditions, when they're down to a low-risk offender, that's when we can start looking at that early discharge. So it's oftentimes for us in our county specifically, not speaking to others, is that if somebody's on supervision, they very well may serve about half their time on supervision if they're being successful. And that's really looking at that, all their conditions would be complete. We would, on our risk assessment, that they would be low risk. If we feel that they're still moderate or high risk to reoffend, we wouldn't look at an early discharge just because we feel that there's possibly more interventions and more programming. But it is something we look at, and partly it's a resource issue. If we did not look at an early discharge program, it'd be really hard to provide supervision within our state. It is already very difficult to provide the services necessary to the individuals we have on probation. And so oftentimes those places will go down to low risk administrative group supervision caseloads. And so I think that's one of the things we look at is it more appropriate to discharge them from supervision or put them onto a caseload where they're getting very limited supervision?
Okay, I think we've expended our list here. You said you had a couple more slides. Why don't you do your slides and then we'll wrap up with a couple questions if there's any.
I will finish up. I'll be very brief. The next slide we were going to cover is just touch on supervised release, and the department is going to give a presentation. But just to be clear, in this Community Corrections Act system, we do supervise releasees on behalf of and through the authority of the Department of Corrections of the state. So we are agents for the Department of Corrections in that respect. So while the practice and the approach of how we deal with offenders is virtually the same from probation to supervised release as far as risk assessments, intervention, et cetera, when it comes to the determination of revocation, that is made by the Department of Corrections through the Hearings and Release Department. They do have a structured grid which does take into account violation criteria and also the response, and I believe they will be talking about that further under their presentation. We did want to touch just briefly on diversion programs as well, because that comes up particularly with felony cases. Statutory authority to offer diversion in Minnesota is technically granted to county attorneys. So county attorneys can run the program themselves, or they can turn around and work with another agency to deliver that service. Most of the counties in Minnesota, it is delivered through their probation department, or in the metro area, there are some private, like 180 degrees or Project Remand that do some of those services. But by and large, diversion is controlled through the prosecuting attorney. The eligibility, who they send, what the criteria are, et cetera, is really controlled by county attorney. And in Minnesota right now, much of the diversion is really not the type of offenders that's going to impact bed space. It's a lot of theft, property offenses, that type of low-level things that aren't going to end up in prison by and large anyway. So diversion doesn't really play a huge part right now in this bed impact. I believe that is all we had at this point. Josh is going to cover resource needs.
And just talking with that, and what we're looking at is, just wanted to make this quick mention, is that we just want to make sure our legislative bodies and are looking at is there's proposed changes now right now from Sentencing Guidelines Commission. There's different bills that are up for consideration. It's just looking at those impacts, if some of those changes are made, that those are again increasing more bodies out on supervision, but just looking at what it would take for resources to give that adequate supervision. Feel it's already difficult to always provide adequate supervision. If we are adding more individuals that would have been in prison instead of the community, that's going to be some resource needs. And just with that funding, is just looking at continuing our evidence-based practices. When we used to supervise in probation 20 years ago, it was not as complex as it is now with evidence-based practices. It is much more complex and needing that resources to be able to provide that within our community. And with that, just looking at how do we continue to expand or create community alternatives. I won't talk much about that, but I know the Department of Corrections is going to talk about a couple programs that they are showing some progress with their Second Chance Act, Demonstration Act, and their MNSER statewide recidivism reduction program. So I'll just leave that more to them so we can move on with our presentation.
Mr. Milo, we put some more money into probation, but tell task force here what you actually wound up with when it was filtered down to you for your jurisdiction in Mankato area.
And for us in Blue Earth County, when after there was the new funding, is that was a $50,000 appropriation for community corrections. And I also think I need to say, with that, is going into 2016, we also lost about $90,000 in state funds, even though we had a net loss of $40,000 to our community corrections department, because we lost other state funding when we got some of that new Community Corrections Act funding.
Yeah, I just wanted to make that clear, that sometimes we think we give them extra funding, that we really put a lot of FTEs or more people down there to help out with their caseload, which we really didn't.
I just want to say, and that funding was appreciated. I mean, that's not something we've always received in our legislative appropriation, so I don't want to make light of that. For us, it was only $50,000. Any appropriation is definitely appreciated to help us serve our community.
Well, that's why I brought it up.
What would be another $50,000 if we hadn't given it?
Another for us, another 500,000.
It,
you lost other places, you would have been a lot deeper in the hole if we hadn't given you the
right.
Money.
I mean, so it was definitely, it would have been a significant loss to us, and that's the place with the Community Corrections Act is that we, although we lost some money, we were able to, for a county, be able to backfill some of that, but that then comes with county levy, and that's, again, looking at what that pressure is for property taxpayers within our community by having additional county levy dollars.
Well, that's the reason I brought it up, is because you folks have never whined about not getting enough money. You just made a presentation and left it at that, and I wanted to make that clear now. That's why I brought it up, because you haven't really complained. So, Mr. Small?
I think he's answered my question.
Okay. Senator Lass?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have in following up to Ms. Mitchell's comment about some states authorizing sort of this quick dip into local jails for a day or two, authority, would you like that kind of authority? Do you think it would be helpful to your ability to manage your clients?
You know, it's an interesting concept, and I would say there is some reservations. I think partly because I've grown up in this correction system where I really look at that being a judicial decision, and we take very seriously when we're taking away the liberty of somebody, and we really look at that as being a judicial response. Having said that, we do have some authority already with an apprehension and detention orders that we can put somebody in jail for up to 72 hours while we're investigating a probation violation. I definitely think it's an interesting concept, and it's not something that's been thrown out, so it's very intriguing. I mean, because what I think what she's really alluding to is that swift and certain, and we're seeing those places, and we're seeing some really positive research that when we're doing a probation violation response, we don't need 30, 60, 90 days in jail. We need 1 day, 2 days. There's some research that we need like 7 days, and so it is really an interesting concept that I think would really need to be vetted and researched more thoroughly.
I'd be interested in whoever would vet that more thoroughly and whether that's appropriate. Also, on the question of probation length, there's been some discussion at some point about the possibility or the options of an earned probation reduction system where you would have the authority or as a recommendation to the judge that, you know, you can tell a probationer if you complete this, if you do this, then you're going to get a reduction in your probation time that's going to reflect, kind of like good time for good behavior while you're in custody, but applied to the length of probation. What are your thoughts on that as a possibility?
Ms. Christensen?
We do have experience with that. We have a counties that border South Dakota, so we get a lot of transfers in from South Dakota, and they have an earned compliance system. For every so many months that you go violation-free, then you get time off of your sentence and then adjust it downwards. I think generally, personally, I'm in favor of that. We have a pretty aggressive early discharge policy in Six West Corrections that we worked out with our local bench and our prosecutors. So we went to that method a while ago because our numbers were just so through the roof, as Josh mentioned. We just don't have capacity to keep folks on that long. So I think that applying that at a statewide basis, that would be my concern, is that is one area where if we were going to do that, we would need to make sure that we did it uniformly and that it was applied to everyone from the same standard and the same expectations with the same benefit.
Mr. Chair, thank you. One of my, going back to the question of diversion programs, one of my frustrations has been observing that at least in some counties you can get diversion for offense number one, and in other counties you can't get diversion for committing the exact same offense. And then there's some disparities even within counties, particularly in the metro area, where you may have city attorneys that will not give you diversion for the misdemeanor level offense, but if you commit the same type of offense but at the felony level, you can get diversion. And I'm thinking in particular theft offenses. If the amount that's involved crosses the threshold to make it a felony, you can get diversion in some counties, and you're better off being able to get that diversion and keep a conviction off your record than if you shoplift something for, which is theft, but $100, and you end up with a theft conviction on your record because your local city attorney does not do diversion or give you options for that kind of an offense. And that theft conviction is on your record for the rest of your life unless you later get it expunged. So So I'm not quite sure how we address that, but in the area of diversion programs, we might want to think about some kind of uniform state guidelines for how to handle those as well.
And I would just echo that, whether it's frustration or of that lack of uniformity, because you're right, there's so much on discretion of whether it's a city prosecutor or a county attorney, that there isn't that uniformity across the state. I think we all know that even somebody being charged with an offense has collateral sanctions and collateral consequences that are going to stick with them quite possibly for the rest of their life. And so if there are ways that we could look at any uniformity across that, that how you could divert lower-level offenders, that is not so much discretion.
So, Mr. Chairman, I've identified in your comments a number of places where you said you thought more resources would be beneficial to ultimately reducing recidivism. One, in terms of domestic abuse programs, to make them more available and more accessible. In mental health services, which we've had lots of talk about before here in this group. Chemical dependency services, similarly, especially services that treat co-occurring disorders. Court system capacity, in terms of being able to get to a swift and certain way of handling proposed violations when it gets to the level of a violation that's proposed. And, of course, what you put on your slide. I'll ask the question, in terms of just within the probationary services themselves, community corrections services, do you think that you have adequate resources now to handle your caseload, or could you do a better job with more resources?
I would say absolutely. Do we feel we're short of resources just within our resources of probation officers within the state? We looked over the last 15 years and where that funding is and where we really feel we've fallen behind. Just having probation officers to manage the caseloads, we try to manage by risk, but because of the numbers we have, there are a lot of individuals within, I would say, each county, each Department of Correction of the county, that could be getting more supervision if we had the resources, but because of our resources, they're getting less services just because we don't have the bodies to supervise them within the community.
I would have to believe that you think your work is productive and effective, and that if there were more people like you in the counties providing more supervision, that it would result in less recidivism. Would you agree with that conclusion?
If I could speak to that,
Ms. Christensen?
Chairman Latz, I think the issue that we're seeing is a combination of two things. As Josh mentioned earlier in the presentation, how we deliver corrections has changed based on research. Corrections is becoming the intervention. It is just as important as chemical dependency treatment, as domestic abuse treatment, as mental health treatment. Those things are important, but the cognitive skills change, working with the offender, getting them to change their thinking and how they approach their life, that is the work of the corrections agent. And you can't do that work if you don't have adequate time to spend with those people. That's the type of work, secondly, that you do with medium and high-risk folks. And the risk of our offenders has been going up. And I took a look, example, in our area. So we had 469 felons sentenced in the four counties, in the last 5 years. So 71% of those offenders were presumptive stays. They weren't going to prison. And 29% were presumptive commits. But the average criminal history score of that group was 3.5. So we're not talking about offenders who don't come with histories already. They have experience and evidence of showing us that they've got cognitive thinking problems. They don't respond to things like we do in their lives. If you look at their risk, 59% of all the assessments we did in 2014, our offenders scored very high or high risk. 59% of our felons are very high or high risk, according to the MHS LSCMI risk assessment tool. That's what everyone in Minnesota uses. And another 29% were medium risk. So that's 44% or higher recidivism likelihood. So we're not dealing with folks. We have already done every intervention we can at the low level to screen these people out, to give them low level of service by default. So the folks that we are left with are the really challenging, high-risk people, and those people take time. And if we don't have adequate interventions and time within our probation caseloads, not to mention those services, we're not going to change and turn that behavior around.
That's kind of a guesswork, I suppose. I would be uncomfortable with giving more funding without some evidence of, I mean, I know you need more funding in general, but to relate it to just risk, I would rather relate it to success or failure of those people. In other words, if they're high risk, but they're still not reoffending and everything's going okay, I would have a hard time giving the funding. If you had some evidence of the people you weren't getting to are screwing up and there was a lot of recidivism in that group, then I'd be more, you know, you'd like to see some relation of funding to success or failure rather than just the high risk. You following me? I mean, if you got X number, you got 10 probation officers and 1,000 people caseload, if everything's going fine, you know, don't really need any more funding at the point, unless you just want to get better at it. If those people aren't failing, if everything's going okay with that group, you know what I'm saying? So I'd like to see some how that unmanaged group is doing, you know, to justify more officers for that.
I mean, I think what I hear with what you're looking at for those outcomes, but I think that is part of it, is that I think we know what we've seen with some of those reductions in recidivism rates over the last 15 years when we've added evidence-based practices, and there's that feeling that we could do better if we had those resources, that you could provide that to more of your offenders. Because we're focusing on those high and medium, but there's also a lot of medium risk that we are not able to focus on like we would like to focus on them, just because we really have to focus on high risk. And if you look in within in a system, you know, where you're putting your resources, there's a lot of resources on sex offenders. I mean, that's not something we're talking about, but there's a lot of resources there. Then you have resources for high risk that are person offenders. And then we've also become a little more compartmentalized with some of problem-solving courts. So we sometimes forget just of those medium and high risk that are also committing crimes within our community.
Okay, that makes a better explanation to me, that to relate the funding so that you could do a better job and reduce recidivism more than just you've got X number of clients out there. We've got Representative Ward and Director Franklin, now Mr. Small, and we really got to get moving. So let's take those three and then finish up if we could. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Very quickly, and maybe you have the answer or not, I'm wanting to go back to the diversion program slide, and I certainly understand that the diversion programs don't implement our affect our conversation about beds now, but is there any evidence that those diversion programs are effective enough that we are not feeding the pipeline for beds as time goes on? And you kind of alluded to some of that in terms of the diversion program comment you made a few minutes ago, but is there any evidence that the diversion programs help us with our population?
Yes, I would add that, not being able to speak to specific research, but I think we know that early intervention and prevention at the earliest of levels is adding success. I mean, if we can start changing individuals' behavior the earlier they're in life, the better chance we have. And we look at if someone that's lived this criminal lifestyle for 20 years or 25 years, and then you're having to try to change your criminal lifestyle that they've learned for 25 years, it's much more difficult if you can have an earlier intervention, even when we're talking about youth intervention, when their brains are still developing. So I think having that's more general, and I can't point to specific research, I think you could definitely find the research that says that early intervention and prevention is very important. And maybe Commissioner Roy might, if he has anything on that as well.
Mr. Chair, diversion is authorized by the prosecutors, and prosecutors don't usually authorize it for high-risk cases, so almost universally those are successful diversions. There are anomalies, but the last reports I've seen, it's very good. And some prosecutors do not engage in diversion activities. They think if you commit or participate in a criminal act that you deserve prosecution. So it varies from county to county, prosecutor to prosecutor, and I will continue to say that prosecutors are the most powerful people in our justice system.
Okay, Representative Ward, you done?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Director Franklin, followed by Mr. Small, and then we can maybe move on.
Mr. Chair, my questions deal right along with Senator Latz on the cost issues and other kinds of things. I don't think any of us disagree with where we're going in terms of trying to change behavior and fulfilling the goals of probation. Accountability is a huge portion and piece of that. And I would just like to throw out this, and maybe it's more of a statement than it is a question. Discretion equals budget capabilities in many, many cases. Programs can't be established if there isn't funding. One of the things I'm not seeing here, and I don't know whether DOC is going to address it, but a future question is, how many people do we actually have on probation in the state of Minnesota? How many people are in the 75% category? How many people are in the 25% category of the state? How much money is actually spent in the two respective budgets? And I don't necessarily want to get to a per widget kind of discussion here, but it would be an interesting discussion at some point in time about how that compares county to county, how many people they have, which gets back to the capability of being able to provide programs, and what other kinds of options are there. As we look at changing or discussing about latitude and decisions that might help you, there's costs associated with that. And I just articulate, as we look at this whole funding issue, and as we look at sentencing guidelines that's coming up here at the end of the month, where we're going to be shifting people back away from the state system to the county system, county jails, and the cost of probations, how are we going to anticipate those changes should that sentencing guideline grid go into effect next year? So I think these are questions that beg a lot more discussion than perhaps we have time for today. But I just raise those as concerns as we look at this big picture.
Okay, Mr. Small.
Has anybody inquired of probation at any point about following up with what Director Franklin just talked about? Has anybody asked probation about what the impact of the changes in the sentencing guidelines might mean to you in probation? Has anybody even asked what your needs might be?
You know, I can't speak to what the decisions at sentencing guidelines, if there was those conversations there with Commissioner Roy being on that sentencing guidelines commission. But for us, for community corrections counties, I haven't heard that question asked about that impact.
No, nobody's asked you.
No.
All right. Thank you.
I think we will, because the sentencing guidelines commission plans on coming before the legislature at some point, I think, for hearing, and then we would probably ask those questions in detail. Yes?
Chair and members of the committee, I just want to remind everyone that there's also another probation department, which is the community probation offices, which supervises the pretrial offenders that are majority felonies that also then go into felony supervision to the Department of Corrections. And a lot of the work that we do at the county level can make appropriate sentences to avoid going to prison, to intervene early regarding getting chemical use assessment, addressing mental health, and yes, resources are scarce on the smaller counties across the state. But I just want to remind everyone that we do supervise felonies, we do supervise juveniles and adult misdemeanor and gross misdemeanors, and the work that we do also impacts if they will graduate into the felony or the CCA or Department of Correction supervision, just as a comment.
Thank you. And Representative Hertaus had a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we've visited different prisons and you get a chance to take a glimpse at the prison population and the people who comprise that population and listening to what you said about cognitive skills and development, the importance of really changing behavior early in life, it sounds like a public safety issue is overlapping into K-12 programming in making sure that these cognitive skills are developed and really preempt in growing and increasing the prison population. You know, we listen, I'm in K-12 as well, so we listen to the failure rate of graduating students and the high achievement gap and issues going on in the inner city. So it, it'd be nice to say that within the confines of a certain area of our legislative responsibilities, you can solve it all within that, but it's very clear this overlaps. And just a comment, thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you very much for your time.
While our next group is coming up here from the Department of Corrections, I just wanted to highlight something that I probably will on each task force meeting, and that's the mental health issue. And Senator Goodwin, probably we're working on some mental health issues in the upcoming legislature. But what I really wanted to emphasize is St. Peter, once again in Anoka, they're due to set a new record of assaults, with a couple sexual assaults against staff here recently. And they're getting close to taking the same action that one of the school districts has. There's been rumors of either walkouts or strikes at St. Peter, or class action lawsuits for failure to management to protect them. They're at a rate of 68 assaults back a while ago. Now they're over 70. They think that they might even reach 100 because some of the results, if it's spitting or punching, aren't even reported as an assault. And so it's getting very serious there. But so before we think about sending people like from the jails to treatment centers, we've got to make sure that any treatment center isn't stuck like Anoka or St. Peter, where they can't use tasers or handcuffs and it basically are literally punching bags for these people. So just something in consideration that I realize there is a problem in the jails and they're not in the treatment beds, and you've been working hard on it with the sheriff up in Beltrami County and things. But we really got to protect those state employees somehow. Okay, it would be Department of Corrections presentation on probation revocations. Mr. Solhide and Rebecca Holmes, Executive Officer of Hearings and Release, and Commissioner Solhide. Either one, go ahead. Welcome.
Representative Cornish, Senator Latz, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us here today to testify. I would like to preface my comments with I did hear my name in the previous presentation come up several times. I do not have all the answers, but I will attempt to answer as many of your questions as we can here today. Also, I would like to comment on the previous presentation that Department of Corrections does face several of the same challenges in the 54 counties where we provide supervision in the state with supervision to probation offenders. So I do have to echo much of what was said here earlier, that we do face these same challenges in those counties with our supervision on probation. But getting to our presentation today, this is specific, and I want to make sure that people are aware that we are talking specifically about offenders who are releasing from prison and are subject to potential revocation and a return to prison. So these are offenders who are on supervised release or parole, not on probation. So it is a different population that we're dealing with here today. Just quickly, by way of an overview, release and revocation from the prisons. The commissioner's authority is regulated by Minnesota Statutes 243.05 and 241.26. They empower the commissioner of corrections to grant and revoke release of a prisoner from our prison facilities. By way of background as well, the U.S. Supreme Court had a decision known as, and it related to Morrissey v. Brewer back in 1972. And what that gets to is when an individual who is on parole or supervised release has a liberty interest in the balance before they can be returned to prison or reincarcerated, the court has determined that we are required to provide due process. So a result of that was that in 1972, as a result of that decision, Minnesota promulgated Rules 2940, which provides the framework that governs the Department of Corrections Hearings and Release Unit, and also known as HRU. What these rules do is they guide the release and revocation process, and they ensure uniformity and objectivity in decisions made by our hearing officers. This slide provides an overview with regard to prison admissions in 2015, fiscal year 2015. At sentencing, offenders are ordered or directed by the courts to serve two-thirds of their sentence incarcerated in prison and one-third in the community on supervision upon release from prison. Fiscal year 15, we had 8,012 offenders admitted to prison, averaging 668 a month coming to prison. If you take a look at the slide, you'll see in the pie graph that 2,758 of those admits were revocations or release violators returning to prison for behavior they committed while out on release status in the community. You'll note that that it was 2,441 individuals. So some of those individuals came back more than once on a release revocation. Another note on this slide would be that of the new commits, the 64.9%, this relates back to the earlier presentation, there were 2,170 that came to us that were probation violators. So sometimes that's where the confusion lies when we talk about violator population. We have probation violators and we have release violators. Getting into how the revocation process occurs, it starts with release from prison, and all offenders who are releasing from prison to community supervision have 13 standard release conditions. So this would apply to all offenders who are releasing to community supervision. We do have a number of offenders who release from prison at expiration or discharge. There are just under 1,000 offenders who release at expiration who we no longer have any authority over, and they have no conditions at that point in time. But of those offenders that do release with conditions, you can see on the left-hand side, offenders must report as directed, maintain approved residence, follow agent instructions, maintain contact with the agent, remain law-abiding, inform agent of contact with law enforcement, pay restitution as directed, and submit to searches. So they are held to a high degree of accountability. We also have the must-nots. Offenders must not possess alcohol or other drugs, possess firearms or dangerous weapons, leave the state, and again, that's a qualifier would be without agent permission. They must not contact victims. They must not demonstrate or engage in assaultive behavior. We do have special groups of offenders releasing from prison that have what we call special conditions or additional conditions. So offenders releasing on intensive supervised release are very high-risk offenders, may have additional conditions such as electronic monitoring as directed by the agent. We have offenders that are releasing who are predatory or sex offenders, and they may have additional conditions such as no possession of pornography, no internet access, no social networking, chat room access. We have offenders who release through our work release program. Those offenders, as example, may have a condition that says find and maintain employment. They are on our work release program. That is a requirement of the program. We have offenders who release through our challenge incarceration program or our boot camp program. They also have additional conditions above and beyond the 13, such as engaging in community service. They're required to complete so many hours of community service as a part of their programming while in the community. And then also we have our conditional release program. Again, those drug and alcohol offenders who qualify under certain conditions to go out early, they will have conditions added such as aftercare and treatment, so to continue with their treatment programming in the community upon release. What this slide depicts is the first 4 months of this year, July through October 31, and this basically gives you an overview, and I see it's not showing up properly on the slide here. If you've got handouts in front of you, I can just reference that. If you take a look, it talks about the category on the left-hand part of the slide is offenders who were revoked and returned to prison. There were 908 offenders who, during that time period, were revoked and returned to prison during those 4 months. And also during that same time period, we had 1,172 offenders who were restructured. And the next slide will get into a little bit of that and kind of give you a flow chart around this. So essentially, our hearings and release unit, as was noted earlier, is the unit that...
Commissioner Stolheim, we got a question.
Go ahead.
I just, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know what it means that when they're restructured to the community, what does that
correct
entail? What does that mean, though?
I will answer that. When they are restructured, that means they remain in the community, so we may revise their conditions of release. We may add conditions of release. We may modify conditions of release, and we maintain them in the community. They do not come back to prison. So on this next slide, as you can see, during the 4 months, July 1 through October 31, our hearings and release unit had 2,080 contacts from agents who are supervising offenders on supervised release or parole in the community. So about 500 calls per month come into our hearings and release unit. How those are managed, if you take a look down the left-hand side, it says restructured to community. Essentially what that means is they remained in the community and those conditions were modified or changed or reinforced with that offender. And that happens in two ways. The first way is when you see it says pre-hearing restructures, 893. What that means is of those 2,080 contacts, 893 offenders had their conditions modified or restructured over the phone in a conversation between the hearing officer and the agent, and it did not involve the offender going to jail and awaiting a hearing. 279 of those 1,172 were instances where it actually went to a hearing, but the hearing essentially, the violation was stayed and the offender remained in the community. So again, as a result of that hearing, they may have had conditions modified or other alternatives enacted. Say they were able to get into chemical dependency treatment, as example, or sex offender treatment or other programming that allowed them to remain in the community. On the other side of that slide, you can see that 908 who had hearings were revoked and returned to prison. We had heard earlier some questions about guidelines. The hearings and release unit does have revocation guidelines. Those guidelines include both the severity, the release condition that was violated, the severity level of that violation, and then a proposed disposition. So this is what our hearing officers operate under when a release violator comes to them for a hearing, when there's a revocation process initiated through the agent submitting the violation. Just briefly, with regard to the severity levels, as you can see, we have a severity level 1. That would refer to minor technical violations. So again, you know, offenders have many conditions lumped upon them when they're released from prison. Some of them may be minor in nature as far as their violations, and when that occurs, if they end up in a hearing process or as the hearing officer is reviewing this with the agent, possibly over the phone, you can see here it says the presumptive disposition is a restructure or a possible revoke for a minimum of 60 days in a return to prison. Severity level 2, which makes up the bulk of the types of violations that we see, are more serious technical violations. Might be an offender who's abusing drugs or alcohol again while they're out on release status, or if they're convicted of any misdemeanor, and there the presumptive restructure is restructure or a revoke for a minimum of 90 days back to prison. Severity level 3, again, multiple technical violations, the more serious technical violations, conviction of a gross misdemeanor would be a presumptive decision to revoke in for a minimum of 120 days back to prison. And severity level four against would be behavior that demonstrates a serious threat to public safety, or conviction of a new felony would be a presumptive decision would be to revoke for a minimum of 150 days back to prison.
Mr. Sewell, I've got a question from Senator Goodwin and Senator Newman.
Senator Cornish.
Thank
Senator
you. Goodwin. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under this chart here, treatment or program failure, the total is 220. I have heard of cases where somebody was given by the court only like 60 days or whatever to start a treatment program, but then there's no treatment program available, or there are some that they can't get into for longer than 60 days or whatever. And because of the lack of resources, are those people included in program failure, treatment or program failure in that number? So if they can't get the treatment, are they still included in that number is my question.
Representative Cornish, Senator Goodwin, I think you're jumping ahead to the next slide, I believe, okay. which is fine, and I can get to that. So this next slide here, with respect to this would be through the hearings and release unit, not through the courts. And when an offender is determined to be in need of treatment, chemical dependency treatment, typically the violation and the severity level would dictate that they come back to prison potentially for adequate time to complete chemical dependency treatment. So an offender could be directed to come back to prison, directed to complete chemical dependency treatment as a part of that hearing process, and we would be looking at that offender potentially having adequate time to complete treatment within our facilities. Clearly, the lower level violations would not have time available to complete treatment, and I can Ms. Holmes respond to that as well.
When a hearing officer does a hearing, if they determine that there's no resources available in the community to address those chemical dependency issues, they may direct them back to prison to complete a treatment program. Based on the type of program that would be available for that offender would determine how long they will return to the institution.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. Then my question from there is, a number of our prisons don't have much in the way of mental health treatment, certainly, and chemical dependency beds in the prisons are really restricted. But their reentry back into prison could be based on the lack of resources, of other resources for them to use, correct?
We would consider both options at that point in time, and if an agent or the offender and their attorney have some options available in the community that we believe would be a better placement for that offender, we certainly would consider that for a resource alternative rather than returning to prison.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Solheid, the revocation guidelines, where does the legal authority come from in order to establish those guidelines? And who is preparing the severity levels and the proposed dispositions? And are those guidelines enforced uniformly statewide?
Senator Letts, Senator Newman. Yes, the legal authority behind those guidelines comes out of promulgated rule 2940, which gives the Department of Corrections the authority for the hearings and release unit and that process. The revocation guidelines are enforced for supervised release offenders statewide uniformly, because that is through the Department of Corrections hearing and release unit, so that it is one specific unit that the hearing officers are trained to conduct hearings utilizing those guidelines. So that is enforced uniformly through all 87 counties for offenders who are on parole or supervised release.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is really back to the previous slide. When looking at severity level 4, one of the violations is conviction of any felony. And my question is, at what time does the conviction of a felony sort of override a revocation? In other words, there's a completely new sentence that's imposed, and you're not actually, you know, doing a revocation for the previous.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr.
Dean,
Solon.
The revocation process would occur as a result of a new felony conviction. So the offender is already on supervision, felony level supervision, for a prior offense. So the revocation process would still occur because of that current supervision that the offender is on. If there is a new felony sentence that extends beyond any time they would receive as a result of that revocation, then they would also serve that time. So one of the prior slides talks about offenders, release violators, coming back with a new felony conviction. So essentially, they would be violated for the behavior or the offense, the new felony offense, on the prior conviction and return to prison for that. They may extend beyond any return time as a result of any new sentence that they've received.
So follow up. So in that case, would there be a concurrent sentencing for the revocation and then for the new offense, or would they be consecutive?
That
Mr. Solon.
Senator Letts, Representative Dean, that time would be served concurrently while they were in prison.
To that point, narrowly, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But isn't it true that there are some crimes that are in the sentencing guidelines that are presumptive consecutive? And so if it's, for example, a felony fleeing a police officer in a motor vehicle and you're on felony probation, there are some crimes that are just presumptively consecutive, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Reitz.
Mr. Chair, it usually depends on the status of the offender at the time they commit the offense for it to be presumptive consecutive. Permissive consecutive is a little different. That depends on the type of crime that was committed.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just clarifying that there are just a section in the sentencing guidelines that specifically has the crimes that are presumptively consecutive that you can, based on the status of the offender.
Ms. Moses.
Thank you, Chair. A quick question about failure to remain law-abiding, ISR, victim minor contact, and assaultive behavior. You may not have this information, but how many of those are offenders with domestic violence offenses as their controlling case? And then how many of those, no matter what their controlling case offense is, how many of those are domestic in context? You may not have that, but just interested to know.
Commissioner Solon.
Senator Letts, Ms. Moses, I do not have that information with me. I did take note of your questions earlier with regard to what is going on in the facilities with regard to domestic violence programming and resources. I will say that our victims and restorative justice unit director and her staff are very actively looking at and identifying offenders in our prison system who are there for current offenses of domestic violence and those with past history of domestic violence. And we are actively seeking programming that, first off, will be shown to be effective for that population. And we are also taking additional steps beyond just identifying these individuals. Recently, our institutions division is revising policies with regard to visitation and victims and their perpetrators and issues around prison visitation. So we are actively engaged in that, and we will try to get more information to you back on that.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question involves the agent contact violation category. You have 588 people in severity level 2 and another 193 in severity level 3. Could you explain what the difference is between those two categories?
Mr. Solon.
Senator Letts, I will let Ms. Holmes respond to that specifically, but I will note these are abbreviated categories. There's probably a paragraph of information that goes along with these, but in order to get them here, we had to abbreviate what those standards were. I would also note, if you take a look at the bottom of that slide, of these are the 908 offenders who came back to prison. On average, they had 2.6 violations per revoked offender. So offenders don't typically come back for maybe just one violation. They may have multiple violations, so I think that's important to note.
I can answer that just a little bit. Because we combined all of our conditions of release into these separate categories, that's exactly what Mr. Solheid stated here, is some of those are combined violations, which brings them up in the guideline grid to a level 2 or 3 based on multiple violations. Typical agent contact violation on a real minor level will be the offender was required to contact the agent at a certain period of time when they returned home from work and they failed to do so, so the agent had to make contact back to the offender to find out how accountable they were being on that supervision period between home and work. And we typically would not send somebody back to prison for that violation behavior. If it were a more serious high-risk offender, a level 3 sex offender who was unaccountable for a lengthy period of time, that in and of itself would rise it on the guideline grid. But these would be a severity level 1 or 2, very low-level type of violation. Even with a couple of violations, they could still be at that low level.
So with that,
Commissioner Sola,
we will continue. Unless there are other questions, we can always go back. Just some demographics. I know it has been discussed earlier, and so we are providing some racial demographics with regard to the number of hearings that we're holding, and essentially the work of HRU and our overall prison population. So if you take a look at the top slide, you can see percentage of hearings. These are the actual cases that went to a hearing. And the percentage is in the various categories. You will note fairly closely mirror our institution population. So the percentage of hearings is actually those offenders that are coming in for hearings. And the column on the right talks about the racial breakdown in our prisons. You will note the one anomaly is our American Indian population. There is a fairly wide disparity there with the number of Native Americans who are coming back and are a percentage of our hearings versus our prison population. And there are a variety of factors that play into that. With regard to gender, if you look at the bottom graph there, you will note that 92% of our folks that come in for hearings are male, 8% are female, and that fairly closely mirrors our institution population as well. So there are no big anomalies throughout this process. I think getting to some of what the current initiatives are, things that maybe were even referenced in the prior presentation, we recently conducted a high-risk revocation reduction project. This was through a Second Chance Act demonstration grant that our agency had received. This focused on offenders, primarily high-risk offenders, releasing from prison. These are release violators that have come back, releasing from our prisons at Lionel Lakes and Rush City back to the metro area. We were able to show with our work with specific to that group a reduced risk of revocation by about 28%. This was not a real large population. Our resources were strained, but the grant helped us to do this. It really illustrated the importance of community-based reentry services. Offenders participating in this were primarily, again, from the metro area. We worked with the hub in North Minneapolis to provide a great deal of access to services. We provided enhanced case planning with these individuals prior to releasing from prison. and the agent was involved in that along with the case manager, getting them connected with resources in the community for employment assistance, stable housing, cognitive behavioral programming, medical and mental health care were all services provided through the hub, and we found that was very successful at reducing revocations. It demonstrates dedication of additional planning and resources towards release violators does promote public safety.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you on that issue. How many people were in that pilot project?
I do not have that with me, but I will get you that information specifically. Okay. And that just wrapped up the study on that pilot project within this last year.
But it shows some
very
promising success of collaborating between the different kind of services that a prisoner may need. But it shows the importance of that,
right,
at least to begin with.
Senator Goodwin, yes, it does. And I will get you a copy of the report. We do have a report that is not available on our website, but I'll make sure you get a copy of the report.
Thank you.
Another initiative that we're currently engaged in is our statewide initiative to reduce recidivism. We were fortunate to be only one of five states chosen to receive funding for this, grant funding for this from the federal government. And essentially what this targets is offenders who are releasing to the 11 counties that make up the vast majority of our prison commits, so which is about half of the Department of Corrections releasees. It focuses on offenders most likely to reoffend, so we are targeting those offenders in prison who are high and very high risk. About 40% of our prison population fall into that category. We are using proven programs, evidence-based practices, integrated case management to work specifically with these offenders. We have essentially shifted caseloads around within our existing case management resources to allow our case managers assigned to these offenders the ability to work more intensely with them and provide for greater contact with these individuals who are high and very high risk. Again, part of this grant, and we are in the second year of this grant, is a big part of this is to provide training to both field agents and service community providers for services, medical, mental health, chemical dependency treatment providers in the community, to provide them with training specific to working with our population, because as noted earlier, we might be able to get them treated for their mental health issues, but if we've done nothing to reduce the criminal thinking or criminality, then what we have is an offender who now has their mental health issues under control but may still continue to commit crimes. Again, there are many collaboration opportunities going on right now under this current initiative, and we still have about a little over a year and a half to go with this grant. And this engages many of the promising practices under the prior Second Chance Act grant. Other activities that are currently underway, we are creating a working group to review technical violations. We are looking at our guidelines with an eye toward evidence-based practices, and we are looking at how we can incorporate the individual offender risk level into our guidelines. As you'll note, it talks about the severity level and the type of violation. We want to incorporate the risk level of that offender into our decision-making process in our guidelines. So we are currently working on that with several partners in this process. And we are also engaged under our MNSER grant, partnering with the community to find local options. Again, our hearing officers in all cases are looking for what is an alternative beyond prison, because our role here is really to try to ensure public safety, and in some cases prison is the appropriate choice, but when there are alternatives available, that is the main focus of our hearing officers and our hearings and release unit. And as stated here, we understand that release violations play a role in reducing the prison population, so we're continuing to actively engage in this work. and that is it with the presentation.
So, Commissioner, the over the last 15 to 20 years, the number of release violations and revocations has gone up quite a bit, as I understand it. Is that fair?
Senator Letts, I would say it has been commensurate with the increase in our prison population. So what I would say, we did a study in 2009 that was presented to the legislature, and the percentages of offenders who were revoked and returned as opposed to the percentage of offenders who are restructured and remaining in the community are relatively the same. The volume is only really increased with the volume of offenders that we're dealing with.
What steps, I know you've identified some of them here, but are there any other steps that the department is taking internally to try to reduce the number of revocations, that putting some pressure on the prison population?
Senator Latz, I would say some of those steps really are ongoing work with providing chemical dependency, sex offender treatment, and as many programs and services as we can within our prison facilities is really where we are trying to have an impact on that recidivism reduction. We've done a great deal of research on programs in prisons to determine what are effective programs at reducing recidivism, and that is where we are targeting our resources.
Any contemplating any changes in your grid here, or as to what's appropriate for revocation, what isn't appropriate for revocation?
Senator Latz, I would say that is some of the ongoing work that we are engaged in. And again, introducing the, now that all 87 counties are essentially utilizing the same assessment tools to look at risk and needs, incorporating offender risk into our decision-making process is the direction that we are headed in.
Mr. Hossie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Solhead, I'd like to ask you the same question that Representative Cornish asked the MACAC representatives. Is there any, are there any statutory changes that the department's identified that might help with your revocation process and possibly reducing the part of the prison population that's created by that, by those individuals?
Commissioner?
Senator Latz, I would be remiss if I didn't turn that over to my boss, who is sitting over here to my left. but essentially, at the present time, we are not looking at statutory changes, I would say, with regard to release violators. It is more the internal process. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hossie, statutory changes, I think probably most directly related to sentencing guidelines, may impact us in our prison population. If certain groups of offenders obviously never come to prison as a result of some of those changes, then release revocation is not an issue for us.
Okay. Ms. Moses.
Thank you, Chair. Deputy Commissioner. I guess, first of all, MCBW would like to thank the Commissioner and the Department for their dedication to looking at issues of domestic violence amongst the prison population. And we'd also like to thank them for their partnership in a grant from the Department of Justice looking at this issue. I think most people think that victims are safe when offenders are incarcerated or after they have served their sentence, and we know that's not the case. One statistic I was really startled by that's come out of the grant project is that we're looking at like 75% to 85% of offenders in Hennepin and St. Louis County have histories of domestic violence. May not be their controlling offense, but they have histories of domestic violence. I think part of the project has been looking at training for agents so that they can recognize domestic violence and take appropriate actions. We were just talking about decreasing the revocations, but there are cases, I think, where revocations are appropriate, and we know agents are identifying those. How much has bed space been a problem with being able to revoke in cases where that would be appropriate?
Commissioner? Representative Cornish, Ms. Moses, as you're aware, we're currently boarding out over 500 offenders in county jails. So our decision-making process is not impacted by the bed space. It is clearly when there is a case that impacts public safety or safety of an individual, especially a victim here, that we are aware of with an offender, that does not weigh into the decision-making process. We will make room.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Mitchell.
Thank you. I was just looking at the information you provided about revocation, your revocation categories, and it looks like the minimum amount of time that an offender would go back for is 60 days. And I was just wondering, is there some magic to the numbers that are in your grid, or is it tied to the, you know, maybe some programming that you want to put them through before releasing them again, or is that something that you might be considering, whether you need those amounts of time?
Commissioner. Representative Cornish, Ms. Mitchell, I'll let Ms. Holmes respond to that as well.
Thank you. Ms. Mitchell, I just our guideline is, it is a guideline. If a hearing officer gets into a hearing room and there is reason to believe that a placement for that offender in the community could occur prior to that 60 days, they certainly would bring that into the viable options. They have the ability to go far less than 60 days if the community is where the hearing officer believes that offender needs to be placed. In addition, if there are aggravating public safety risk type issues involved with the case, they hence could go higher as well. It is a guideline. It is a starting point for the hearing officer, and they would then incorporate both aggravating and mitigating factors for the circumstances, because each case is so different.
Representative Dean and Mr. Wright.
So, and to that point, my question, thank you, Mr. Chair, is in those, and maybe it's just an assumption I'm going to make, that with severities level 1 and 2, that the time between the violation and the time in which they're maybe, if it's revoked, that they're recommitted is shorter than, say, with severity levels 3 and 4. I guess what I'm trying to get at is there's evidence that shows that shorter stints that are quicker to the actual offense tend to have a much, much more positive impact than violations where it may take 60 or 90 days before the actual recommitment takes place. Is that something that you're all looking at, thinking about? And if so, what's your current practice, and what are some of the things that you may be thinking about in the future?
Commissioner.
Representative Cornish, Representative Dean. Maybe just to give you an overview, the operations of the hearings and release unit, which maybe was remiss in not including in here. When an offender is, picked up on a warrant, so when that contact is made to the hearings and release unit, and it has been determined that we are going to issue a warrant, or the agent takes that offender into custody for this alleged violation, they are brought to jail, and we are required to have that hearing for that offender within 12 working days of their admission to jail. So when you talk about swift and certain, or that punishment occurring prior or quickly right after the violation, essentially for release violators, that does occur rather quickly because that hearing is held within that 12 working days, and the decision is made at that point in time whether to return to prison or to remain in the community with new conditions.
Ms. Meadowbrook?
Deputy Commissioner, could you address the concern about housing for the releasees? I notice on the violation for approved residence, that's one of the violations, and it's based on experience from the attorneys in my office that most of those are based on people that are homeless and that they cannot find housing when they get out of, when they're ready to be released from prison. And so there's a total here of 62 that are returned to prison because of that situation. And also it's my understanding that a lot of them end up being continued longer because once they get sent or violated and sent back to prison because they don't have any place to live, that they again can't get out because it's still the same problem. So they extend the time, and it seems that that really impacts your bed space.
Commissioner. Mr. Chair. Ms. Middlebrook. Yes, the issue of housing is a concern for a serious concern for us. We do have offenders, primarily our high-risk sex offenders, offenders on intensive supervised release, who may come back for a violation of not having an approvable residence, or have multiple violations, you know, possibly assaultive behavior and not having an approvable residence. And it does impact our ability to return them to the community when there is not an approvable residence available. And in some cases, offenders are continued until we can work with them along with the case manager and the agent and the offender to establish a viable residence for their release. So that does impact our population. Currently, there are about 31 communities, I believe, with residency restrictions specific to sex offenders, and that continues to grow, which does inhibit our ability to find residences for some of these offenders releasing from prison.
Director Wrights.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner, I think you told us that there were a significant number of folks who were getting out of prison without any kind of supervision period at all. And I assume that some of those may have been short-term offenders who had a lot of credit for time served and maybe executed their sentence. But I assume that a number of those are also people who whose behavior in prison was so poor that they used up all that one-third period of time on disciplinary time in prison and then were released directly into the community without any supervision at all. And I'm wondering if you're satisfied with the legal framework that permits a situation to be where somebody whose behavior, I assume, was high risk if their behavior was so poor in prison that they chewed up all their supervised release time inside the prison, where they're just basically dumped into the community.
Commissioner? Mr. Chair, Mr. Wrights, you are correct. That is a concern for us. There are offenders. The majority that are exiting at expiration or discharge, I suspect, are offenders that, again, have short durations to serve. But there are those offenders who, as a result of their behavior in prison, do get extended incarceration time and end up spending all of their sentence, their two-thirds and one-third, in prison and releasing to the streets without any supervision. That can occur. We have been examining that on our institution side with regard to our use of extended incarceration side, with regard to our use of extended incarceration, and looking at ways that we can mitigate that as well.
Yeah, I'd like to give the last 30 minutes to the next presenters, but any other questions, Mike? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine will be brief. With the Second Chance Act demonstration project, would you anticipate that 28% reduction of risk would still hold if it was scaled up beyond sort of the current the demonstration that just happened, and what would need to happen in order to make that happen?
Mr. Chair, I guess I am not in a position to predict that. But our expectation would be, since the offenders we were working with in that project were high-risk offenders releasing to the metro area, I would expect that we would experience similar results. I can't say that they would be exactly the same, but we do know that those additional supports that we put into place were effective at reducing future revocations.
Representative Hilston.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I want to go back to the offenders that you released at expiration. Do you track how many of those there are and then how quickly you see them back? And do you see the majority of them back in prison within a short period of time because they've committed new offenses? Or do you not track those folks?
Commissioner. Representative Cornish, Representative Hillstrom. We do track those that are releasing essentially a discharge or expiration. There were about 900 in 2015, I believe. As far as tracking whether or not and how quickly they returned, that I can't answer at this point, but I can check into that and get back to you.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that data would be very, very helpful to know how much of a concern that is and how quickly we need to do something about it.
Sure.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Turn to the left. Thank you. Just at some point, could you provide us with some numbers to what would be involved in taking that Second Chance Act programming and making it longer term?
Commissioner?
Certainly, we'll try to do so.
Okay, thank you very much for your presentation. Dan Kane, president of RS Eaton. Can you do your presentation, Mr. Kane, in 28 minutes? I'd like to be done at noon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I realize that this has gone long. I don't need it. And I'll try and be as brief as possible. My name is Dan Kane. I'm the president of RS Eaton, which is a community social service program that deals primarily with people who have criminal records and are on some type of supervision. We have three halfway houses, four treatment programs licensed by the state of Minnesota for chemical dependency. We supervise community service people. We have a drug testing lab, and until recently, we ran an electronic monitoring business. I also chaired the Sentencing Commission through much of the 1980s, and I'm fairly familiar with the current state of the sentencing guidelines. I was asked to talk about prisoner reentry, and obviously with more people going to prison than ever before, it stands to reason that there's more people coming out. And this legislature, along with Congress, is considering changes that will accelerate that process. I'm not sure that the community is ready for even the numbers that will come out of Minnesota. Nonetheless, we do our best. People coming out of prison need many things to enhance their chance for a successful transition. And it's important to remember that a successful transition is just as or more important to public safety as it is to anything resembling what people like to refer to as hug-a-thug. A reformed offender not only reduces potential criminal activity through their personal changes, but they impact on the activity of others who know them or knew them when. And there are several variables that enhance or inhibit the likelihood of successful reentry. First is the experience the offender has while incarcerated. The Department of Corrections, along with community programs, has prioritized what are termed evidence-based practices in the treatment of offenders. Unfortunately, resources have not kept up with the increases in the offender population, and only a fraction of those identified as needing those services receive them. Risk assessment tools determine who has access. The department has also made a philosophical change directing more case management services towards helping offenders prepare for release at the very beginning of their sentence when they used to go toward preparing them to be a better inmate. Second, released offenders need to have a safe and appropriate place to land when they come out. Safe for them and safe for the community. For some, that means a halfway house. For others, that means treatment, either chemical dependency treatment or mental health treatment. And I'd like to stress, hearing the conversations earlier, that it's appropriate treatment. I mean, there's a lot of treatment out there that has no experience dealing with offenders. And when you send an offender to a program that doesn't have experience dealing with offenders, you have the potential to set that offender up for failure. There are many programs that discharge people for the very behavior that they're sent to the program for. And there are some anomalies between the requirements of the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services that I'll get to later that I think could enhance that. For others coming out, you know, they've developed a release plan, have sufficient family and community support that they can go home. But regardless, They need supervision and, more importantly, accountability. There are currently just over 300 licensed halfway house beds in the state of Minnesota, roughly the same number as there were in 1980 when there were 1,800 adult inmates in the state. To complicate matters, rate increases for halfway houses in competition with funding for incarceration have increased only by 2.5% over the last 8 years. That's insufficient to maintain the quality that we expect. Likewise, over 10,000 inmates and 8,000 releases per year from prison alone, supervision caseloads, as you've already heard from the people from MACAC and the department, have increased exponentially. And as a result, we've developed caseloads based upon crime severity and risk, some sufficient to be managed, others that are unwieldy and too large, and we've come to rely much more on less personal forms of supervision, such as electronic monitoring, urine analysis, and day reporting, which, while somewhat comforting, never replace face-to-face contact with the supervising agent. I mentioned earlier some of the complications and the conflicts between the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections, through their MNSIR project, is working to enhance program's ability to deal with criminogenic thinking and behavior. At the same time, the Department of Human Services is wrestling with something called the Institution for Mental Disorders prohibition that exists in federal government. We've asked for a waiver. We haven't received it. But the Institution for Mental Disorders regulation from the federal government restricts programs that provide substance abuse treatment and mental health services to under 16 clients that are residential. Now, a 16-bed facility is not sustainable financially, although there will be those who will set them up. But the fact remains that most of the people coming out of corrections need residential placement so as to remove them from the community and the conditions which contributed to their problems in the first place. Third, people need a job, and a job that's able to sustain them, not simply a job to satisfy their conditions of release or their work release. We've made progress on removing some of the barriers to offender employment, such as Ban the Box, but with the internet and the advent of data miners, anyone with access to a computer can find a criminal record. And with the residual responsibility to offenders and landlords for wrongful hiring, if they hire an offender or rent to an offender who later reoffends, and some responsibility going to the landlord or the employer, it becomes a great inhibition for people to take a risk on folks. In addition, the state has imposed collateral sanctions that prohibit those with a record from being employed in many jobs, ranging from working in rental property to working in a gas station that sells lottery tickets to mucking out the stalls at Caterbury Downs. In 2008, the legislature commissioned a bipartisan report titled Collateral Consequence of a Criminal Conviction. To the best of my knowledge, none of the recommendations in that report were ever enacted. Fourth, they need a place to live. And I didn't mention it before, but we also have 500 units of sober supportive housing under our supervision, but it's all permanent housing. And unfortunately, the turnover is such that we can't respond to the need. As mentioned earlier, some go to halfway houses, but when they don't, or when their time at the halfway house is done, they need to find a housing alternative. Same background checks that inhibit their ability to find gainful employment limit their access to housing. Some move in with family, but even that is prohibited when they're a drug offender and the family lives in subsidized housing. The family either needs to move out of that housing or not reunite with the offender. Fifth, they need to adjust to a changing world. Not only have we increased the number of offenders, but we've increased the sentences so that they spend more time incarcerated and away from their community. I believe the average time in prison has gone up some 20% since the enactment of the sentencing guidelines in 1980. For many things, such as simple as going to Walmart, taking the light rail or figuring out where the handle is to turn on the faucet in the bathroom are foreign because they didn't exist or have changed since the start of their time away. Preparing them for a world, especially if they've been away from their community and they have little community support that has changed drastically since their time away, is a very important part of their reentry. Last, they need a positive social structure. Most offenders before going to prison surround themselves with people who look just like them in everything from the types of crimes they commit to the drugs that they use. Without intervention and access to the evidence-based services mentioned earlier, this can continue throughout their incarceration and contribute to separation in a pecking order even within the institution. When they leave incarceration, if they continue to go back to their old social group, they'll most likely continue in their antisocial behavior and either violate their conditions of release or reoffend. Loneliness is one of the bigger triggers for relapse, both with criminal behavior and drug use. And unfortunately, when an offender gets lonely, they have a group that will welcome them back with open arms. Yet developing new friends is extremely difficult, even for the most well-rounded individual. None of us goes into Walmart, walks up to someone in the aisle and says, "Hi, my name's Dan, do you want to be my friend?" Yet, despite these challenges, Minnesota does as good a job at reentry as others and enjoys a comparatively low imprisonment rate and a comparatively low crime rate. We have passionate and committed people both in the prison side of the equation and the community side, but we need the resources to do our jobs. A disproportionate amount of offenders who can't find gainful employment, can't find a respectful place to live, and can't find acceptance in their community or get the services that they need that are appropriate and understand the needs of an offender does not bode well for the decisions we ask them to make moving forward. As we thoughtfully ponder having fewer in prison and more in the community, we need to just as thoughtfully plan for how the community is prepared to respond. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, sir. I didn't mean to rush you, but most of them had two people and slides, and since you didn't, I thought you could probably take half the time.
Okay.
You did a good job.
Well, there's someone in the audience that said, stay focused and be timely. So
you were. Representative Schoen had a question, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Goodwin, I'm going to ask a question that you may recognize, or this is new to me. I just heard about this. When you talked about the 16-bed facilities and you said they wouldn't be financially viable, are you talking about IMDs?
I'm talking about IMDs.
Well, then you understand that there's no federal reimbursement for facilities that are over 16 beds, because that's a new thing that's coming up in the state of Minnesota as well through the DHS.
We're
having some reimbursement issues with the federal government on that. It's going to be a major issue.
Mr. Chair, I do understand that, and it's been communicated to us that the state will maintain the Consolidated Treatment Fund, at least before there was a change in leadership at DHS, and that will be used to assure that larger facilities that are already proven and that are doing good work will continue to get clients. But it does present a residual problem, because in those programs that receive funding through the Consolidated Fund, 20% of the funding comes from counties, and counties are the ones that authorize placement. So it could well trickle down to where counties don't use programs. And again, a 16-bed residential program at the rates that are currently paid for services and the expectations and the unfunded mandates that go into treatment is not sustainable.
Ms. Senator Goodwin. Oh, did you have a follow-up?
Oh, no, I said I thanked him for his input. This is something I just learned about recently from my sister, actually, who is part of it. She works as an administrator at Project Turnabout. So I was curious.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And quickly, I just want to say that thank you for that. For bringing that issue up, because it's huge. And all over the state, you know, it's the same issue for getting residential treatment beds for people with MI and CD. And I really think the federal government has to change that. I think at the time when we deinstitutionalized, they didn't want great big institutions, but the number they came up with, 16, really has no rhyme or reason to it. But there are areas like, you know, I've been working with Beltrami County that really want, 70% of their jail inmates have a mental illness, so they really know they need more than 16 beds for the crisis center that we created in last year's legislation. And I think we all need to think about resolutions to our federal government that will encourage them to take another good look at that. And every state in the nation is having an issue with that. You can have more than 60 beds, but you can't get any Medicaid payment for it, which is mostly what people that go there do use.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, the states have the ability to request a waiver from the IMD. The IMD was put in place shortly after the state hospitals closed. It was to prevent the creation of large institutions warehousing people like we eliminated back in the 1960s. There should be a change in federal regulations recognizing that we're no longer in the 1960s. The state, California was granted a waiver. I know that was one state. This state should aggressively pursue a waiver.
I've got a quick series of questions about a situation that's developed and give you the general parameters that an organization has acquired some property and it's for the recovery, adult alcohol recovery, men in particular. When they do this and they have this, what is their usual string of funding? Is it state grants, federal, private donations, or what is the string of funding?
Well, Representative Cornish, members of the committee, it varies. Typically, if they take public pay clients, it's through the state right now through the Consolidated Treatment Fund. And with the advent of the Affordable Care Act, the state will be able to recover those funds through Medicaid. There's also private insurance, and we're unsure just yet how those insurance people who've bought insurance through the exchange, how those programs will work for us. There's also a PMAP population, which has private insurance, but it's paid for by the state. And we don't know how much the state has the ability to regulate or dictate where those people go. It goes back to what I said earlier. It's important for offenders to, I mean, people who are offenders cover a wide spectrum of issues. You know, they're not just offenders. They're not just mentally ill. They're not just chemically dependent. They're not just domestic abusers. They're not just homeless. They're not just chronically unemployed. Many of them are all of the above. And our system is designed to treat those things one at a time. And, you know, and in particular, our systems are set up, those that are treating those things one at a time, to where they don't have the organizational or the philosophical capacity, oftentimes, to deal with an offender population. And we have to be careful. As I said, the department, under their MNSER project, has developed a process where they'll partner with the Department of Human Services and provide for programs to gain expertise in the evidence-based practices that have been instituted in prison and to develop a specialty for dealing with offenders, but it's still in its infancy.
The question I had is, I saw the letter from this organization that they sent out to the community, and it said adult male in recovery, and they didn't say if it's just alcohol. The impression the community got was just alcohol recovery and alcohol offenses, but could it be that it's very serious offense originally, and they're just trying to treat the symptom of that that caused that to get at it? And what's the duty of the organization to inform the community of what their past offenses are? Because in the letter it said a background check will be done on each client, and if we think that they're a threat, they wouldn't be allowed into the... So we're wondering if it's very serious or and if it's just them that make that determination of it's a threat. Or
Representative Cornish, there are programs throughout the state who refuse to take offenders. And there are very few programs that will take sex offenders. So they have the ability to answer, short answer to your question is they have the ability to state that we exclude these people, this population.
Would they have a duty to, or would it be protected by HIPAA or whatever? Say if the community wasn't comfortable with the organization saying we don't believe this person is a threat and won't divulge their past offenses, do they have a duty to divulge that information so the community can ascertain whether it's a threat?
Representative Cornish, I'm not certain of that answer, but my inclination is no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the line of questioning that we were on prior to your line of questioning, I want to raise another issue. So we have a different standard for not guilty by reason of mental illness versus the standard for commitment as a danger to self and others. Don't you see, or do you see, a gap when you may have someone who's found not guilty by reason of mental illness, so they're not entitled to any services because they're not on probation, they're not on anything there, and then they go to the mental health system and they're not committable because they're not a danger to themselves or others, and so they're not in that system. And so ultimately you have someone that you now know has committed criminal activity because of their mental illness, yet they're not entitled to any resources or services in either system.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I'm not certain I know the answer to that question. I know that courts routinely offer order treatment to certain types of programs, chemical dependency programs, and I believe mental health programs, but they can't order payment, so they might be in a position where they recommend that an offender or even require an offender go to a particular program, and the assessment that's done on that offender doesn't support that program, so it doesn't follow through. There are people who fall through the cracks. There's also a very difficult time lag between the time when people seek treatment and when they get into treatment that causes problems, even in particular with a mental health client. You know, even if they're going to get treatment, if they can't get it for several weeks and have to remain in jail or in the community, that's problematic.
You know, I just had a client that had an offense in August who didn't have the funds to get a chemical use assessment until October and didn't have insurance to start covering the recommended treatment until January. And so now he's ready to start treatment. He's been ready to start treatment since August. And he's clearly needed it. But for all these reasons, I mean, he's not going to get it until 4 or 5 months later. And that's just one individual falling through the cracks here. And the public is much safer if he gets into treatment promptly like he needs.
Representative Cornish, Senator Latz, that's a challenge that we all deal with. What we know is the longer the offender, whether it's through a release or ordered probation through court with an expectation of treatment, the longer the offender remains in the community, the less likely they'll get to treatment and the less likely treatment will be effective. Now, the Department of Human Services for Substance Abuse Treatment, if it's public pay, has authorized treatment programs to actual clinicians to do Rule 25s in many programs. Rule 25 assessment is what qualifies someone for state-funded treatment. And I guess what I'm saying is that there are workarounds for the problem that you've described, and if it comes up again, I'd be happy to help you figure that out.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, and it was a great meeting, and I love it when there's no grandstanding, no fights, and we end on time. So our next meeting is January 15th. A note on your, I think there was a bulletin that went out or some on January 13th, but the meeting is actually January 15th, correct? Any questions? Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. I unfortunately will be out of the country when that meeting happens, and that's a very important meeting to me, but I can't change my plans, but I do want to remind this task force that the mental health issue, as you can see, has been discussed a lot, and I've done a lot of discussing on it. But I do think we are spending a tremendous amount and wasting a tremendous amount of money, productivity, and so forth, by not having the mental health resources that we need. And we need to have resources that, as Mr. Kane said, that will take offenders, and many states are doing it. We are not doing anything in that area, and in our last budget we had only eight adult mental health beds, additional beds approved. That still makes us the lowest in the nation. So until we really decide actively that we're going to do something in this area, we're still going to have 30% to 70% of our prison, of our jail inmates having a mental health issue, many of them low-level offenders. A lot of them. We're still going to have, the probation issue where they stay on probation or they have to go back to prison jail because they didn't get the mental health treatment that they needed, and the chemical dependency treatment as well. And I liked what Mr. Kane had to say about all of these different treatments that one person might need are all in different silos, and I don't think until we have some kind of a hub system where we can direct them to the right places for their different issues, we're going to have very much success in that area either. So I'm sorry I'm taking up more time, but I just think this is such an important issue in the state of Minnesota, and that we are so far behind on mental health care. And you really have to take a look at it when our crime rate is going way down, and yet our number of prisoners are going way up. Who are those people then that are ending up in jail and prison if our crime rate is going down? So I think it's people that need other kinds of treatment. And when, as long as that treatment's not available, as long as we don't have enough chemical dependency or mental health treatment, we're going to be building more jail beds and more prison beds, and we're going to be treating people in a bizarre way that need other kinds of help. So I won't be able to be here next time, and I really wish I could, but I really hope that this group does a very thorough discussion about that issue and thinks of ways we can. Another issue is that we don't have enough mental health help in the jails and prisons. People go in and then they go out, and they go in and they go out. And people with mental health issues can be jailed 15 times in a year for small things like trespassing or whatever. And just think of the costs of that. Every state in the nation is working on this, but Minnesota has absolutely the longest way to go to get something. Jail diversion programs diversion programs in jails so that they're not just let out on the street and back in again, and some more mental health resources in prisons. When I went to Rush City, I was surprised at the one little small office they have with 1,500 prisoners for mental health services, and I know they plan on adding some to that if they get their beds. But that's not the entire solution either. But we certainly do need to take care of people when they're in prison and have a mental health issue, and take care of people when they're in jail when they have a mental health issue. And we need to try to get Medicaid reimbursement for jails, because they end up having to pay for very expensive medications because Medicaid will not cover somebody when they're in jail. So I'm sure I had a lot more to say about it, but thanks for listening to that much.
Thank you, Senator Goodwin. And quick comment by Representative.
Actually, it's a quick question, Mr. Chair. I met with a young lady, a lobbyist, that told me that CCA is now open to the idea of selling the prison in Appleton, and that the last time it was assessed at $17 million. Is that right? Am I missing something here?
You haven't heard the latest rumor.
I
haven't heard something
okay,
we can
thank
talk
you.
About.
Yeah.
All right. With that, meeting adjourned.